This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person with an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a troublemaker. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and who expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think. As many of you know, my unconventional ideas and my unwillingness to be quiet about them have made it impossible for me to have a career as a regular professor. And frankly, the more that I share my ideas with people outside academia, like with this podcast, the less I want to be a regular professor. I'd much rather do this than say all the things you're supposed to say to get tenure. The amazing response to this show has made it possible for me, for the first time in my life, to have a career where I no longer have to worry about what the people who run universities think about me. But right now, that's only a possibility. So if you like this show and want to keep it going, and you want to make this adjunct professor into a former adjunct professor, I need your help. I've started a program for supporters of the show. You can join it at unregisteredlisteners.com. If you make a contribution, you won't just be helping the show, you'll also be joining an online community that I've created, where we can all talk to each other, and you'll receive gifts of unregistered merchandise, access to archived episodes, transcripts of the interviews, autographed copies of my books, access to webinars on history, politics, culture, and philosophy, and a free download of my 11-part lecture course on A Renegade History of the United States. I really hope you can join me in this remarkable project, and thanks for listening. I know this week's guest both intimately and not at all, which is to say that our relationship is very much like the relationships of the characters in her book. Rebecca Schiff is the author of The Bed Moved, which is one of the finest and most renegade works of fiction I have ever read. It received glowing reviews in the New York Times, The New Yorker, The Atlantic, and The Nation. It's hilarious, heartbreaking, and a devastating critique of middle-class American life, both in the leafy suburbs where she grew up and in the bars and bedrooms of hipster Brooklyn, where she decided to go very much her own way. When we talked, Rebecca sort of turned the tables on me. Her questions about my life and my relationships brought some things out of me that I've never discussed in public. I think I'm supposed to care, but I really don't. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, Pat.
This is weird, isn't it?
it's funny that we're meeting in real life for the first time on a podcast.
I know. It's weird in a lot of ways. So can I just tell the story?
Sure. Yeah.
The various levels of weirdness that we're encountering right now. So you and I have known each other for what, 5 years, 6 years?
I don't know when we met online. I can't remember the year.
So you were a Facebook friend.
Right.
And we mostly talk politics.
I had assigned your essay on Beyonce to my students because I was teaching composition at Kingsborough, which is a community college in Brooklyn. And I would assign, I think I found out about you because you and John the Collar co-wrote an article about how division in the labor movement is good. And so I started and I like looked up your stuff after that and found the Beyonce article, which I really liked because it was like about pop culture, but it was political and like they could connect with it because they were, you know, teenagers. And so I would assign it. And then I guess I became Facebook friends with you. And I actually thought you were black.
That was proven correct.
And it was correct. Right. Yeah. And you were black. And then, so that was like the prehistory of like how I knew who you were. And I guess I must have friended you because I don't think you knew who I was. Yeah.
But. Yeah. So that was an article I wrote many, many years ago for Slate. I think it was for Slate.
Yeah.
Or Salon. No, it was for Salon. That's right. Yeah. It was for Salon. And it was the argument, which appears partly in Renegade History, and it's going to appear in a big way in my next book called Blood and Freedom, where I talk about the history of American popular culture and its subversive influences in mm-hmm. other countries. So yeah, the argument there was that Beyonce and hip hop generally, and sort of rhythm and blues, black music, was the considered by the mullahs in the Middle East to be the major threat to their rule. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that was a fun article. And I forgot that that's what you
before the revolution.
Before the Arab Spring.
Arab Spring, and I think it was sort of like saying they were like that.
It was before the Arab Spring.
It was before the Arab Spring.
I was prescient.
Yeah, it was very prescient, uh-huh. and it was kind of like this is like a sign that something is happening here, that she's so popular, and there were some other homegrown R&B artists or name.
There were and are a lot of pop stars in the Middle East who are sort of neither
yes.
American in their style nor Egyptian or Saudi.
Right.
It's a hybrid style.
Right.
Which is, you know, they clearly are borrowing from people like Beyonce, mm-hmm. but they also sing in Arabic and they sing about, you know, the mm-hmm. lyrics are not mm-hmm. exactly American. And those are huge stars. They are the Beyoncés of their countries, and mm-hmm. they often get censored and often are considered to be
right.
the problem with our country, say the religious leaders. So yeah, Beyoncé will win the war on terror, not the 82nd Airborne.
Yeah, that was the argument. And look at her now.
There you go.
Look at her now. Look at them now.
Okay, so enough filibustering.
Okay.
We're going to get to this.
Okay.
The strange thing between us. There's a few strange things. So, all right. So you liked my article, and then we friended each other on Facebook, and you had as a professor at Wesleyan, Jonathan Cutler, you mentioned just now, mm-hmm. who was a very good friend of mine who, a lot of people don't know this, but a lot of the ideas that I have are really developments of his ideas that he, mm-hmm. I met him in the late 90s. We were both graduate students, and I was struggling at Columbia and in New York City with the left, and I didn't like the left. I was really uncomfortable with it. I didn't know mm-hmm. why exactly. And I had some ideas about politics that were contrary to the left, but I was getting in trouble, but I just couldn't put it all together. And he just mm-hmm. sort of gave me a key and said, here, put this in the lock. Mm-hmm. And I did that, and it just mm-hmm. everything started to make sense to me. And I realize now that that was the beginning of sort of my new career. I had sort of a different career earlier as a labor historian, social historian, mm-hmm. socialist, et cetera. And the Thaddeus Russell that most people know now really got his start from long conversations with your professor, Jonathan Cutler, who is in sociology at Wesleyan. So that was another connection we had. And so we became Facebook friends, and we talked about politics on Facebook mm-hmm. for a while. I was in the midst of a horrendous relationship at the time. I had been divorced recently and was with a much younger woman, and it was completely toxic, and I was dying. And then I broke up with her.
Yes.
And then you and I remember, I think what happened was I posted on Facebook one day, and this was true.
I remember
this. Is this right?
Yeah.
I heard my neighbors having an orgasm.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
I think that was the beginning.
Yeah.
Of a new phase in our relationship. So I just said on Facebook, I made a joke because I heard.
You also posted that you and your girlfriend had like broken up or something.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So I was like up to date. So basically we started sexting, uh-huh. I guess. But first we started talking. We were like chatting, and then it became sexting.
Is that what it's called? I was going to ask you that. I don't know.
It's definitely called sexting. Yeah.
Is it called sexting what we did?
Yeah, but it was only... I think it was mostly using Facebook messages.
Yeah, it was all on Facebook.
It's not texting, which is where sexting comes from, but it was like, I think it all falls under the rubric of sexting. But we also had like talked about our lives and stuff. We weren't like, it wasn't like mm-hmm. just a sexting thing. But then you were also getting together with your girlfriend, who's still your mm-hmm. girlfriend, at this around the same time. And then we were supposed to meet and like go live with our sexting, but that didn't happen.
Who chickened out?
You did.
I did.
You definitely did.
Mm.
Because I was going to this wedding actually with my family, and I was like, oh, it's so annoying, I have to go to this wedding, but like I'm gonna like get to meet Thaddeus Russell and like maybe have sex instead of like just being stuck at this wedding. And then you bailed, and I was like at the wedding being like, I'm so upset, like I just wanted to like I was really upset because I had been like sort of using it as my like out from this all these obligations as something that I would get to look
oh that's
forward.
All I was to you
No, it was more than that. It was exciting. I think at that time, I was beginning to like understand that I sort of like, which came more clear to me later, that I was like wanted to. I'd always sort of had crushes on like older guys and on professors, probably Jonathan Cutler included. But I was like started realizing that that was like a thing I was like interested in. And since our thing, like I did kind of like get to like have an affair with an older guy, and it didn't end well, actually, the real thing. Mm-hmm. And now I'm with someone who's like younger than me, and so.
Oh really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. Only like a year and a half younger, but I think like I don't know. I think that I'm not sure exactly what it's about, but I think it was about maybe being seen a certain way and wanting that
the status of being with a professor or an academic, or
I don't know if it's about status for me, maybe, but I think it was more about like wanting the brain connection to mm-hmm. combine with the attraction and stuff, and like I'd always been kind of trying to put those two things together.
Yes.
and trying to figure it out. So I think that oh, and also just looking for smart people to know. So mm-hmm. I think that was like, it did mean something to me, because you were sort of seeing both levels of me, that I was like intelligent and that I was cute and sexy.
Yeah. So we were having this sex thing. Yeah. So now everybody knows everything about me. I think I can now retire, right? I think we're done here. I've now revealed pretty much everything there is to know. So, which is good, right? Now we are, you and I, no one can attack us anymore, right? We have this total shield. We're invulnerable to all attacks. There's no shame anymore.
No one's running for office. So it's not,
that's for sure.
It's not,
certainly not after this.
Not after this. No.
Yeah, I have to say that sexting with a brilliant writer is not the worst sex you will have.
Yeah, it's an art, the art of sexting.
I will also say that there's some logistical issues with it, right? Because you're typing.
You're typing. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you're sending I can like refer to other. I don't know if you've ever sexted before or
no.
since, but I have. And sometimes there's like video components.
Oh.
And
you're advanced.
I'm advanced. There's like live, you can do it live, like just
sure.
on like video chat. Mm-hmm. But then sometimes it's like typing mixed with like sending pictures and sometimes recordings. Like it's very multimedia. I do like it. I don't know. It's sort of like, and you were going to bring this up actually about distance, which is a topic in
yeah.
The Bad Move, which is a book, that I wrote, which is that I think that something about the, like I was sexting with this guy in Brooklyn for like years. Like we actually had sex once, and then he lived like in Williamsburg.
And you both lived in Brooklyn.
Yes, he lived in Williamsburg and I lived in Prospect Heights, and we were literally,
well, those people never talked to each
too
other.
Too lazy to ever get together again. So we just sexted for like years. We probably wouldn't have kept like, we probably wouldn't have been able to go for years with whatever connection we had like otherwise. But it does have this, you know, you don't have to like, you don't have to be self-conscious or mm-hmm. deal with the human mm-hmm. component of mm-hmm. interacting, I guess.
Smells, fluids.
Fluids, showering, and all that. All
bad
that
breath.
Stuff.
What do you do in the morning, right? The next morning, all that awkwardness.
Right, all that.
Do you just walk out? Do you have breakfast? Do you talk? What do you say?
Right. It's very casual. In this.
And you and I, I wouldn't call it romantic, but we certainly talked a lot about each other, not just the sexual stuff, but mm-hmm. I got to know you pretty well. And I think you got to know me very well, right?
I did, yeah.
We talked a lot about a lot of stuff that was very intimate, right?
Right. Yeah. I know about your
a lot
family.
Of painful stuff.
Painful
and
stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
And, all right. So yeah, there you go. I'm now done. I'm now revealed everything. grown ass man sexting, masturbating while typing to a woman in Brooklyn. So I was in Los Angeles.
I was an adult. I mean,
I know.
I was like just a young 33.
My point was that I was a grown ass man acting like a teenager. So you were in Brooklyn. I was in Los Angeles. I was in this terrible, or no, I just left this terrible, terrible relationship. I was kind of in between, single for the, oh, this is the thing that's so pathetic about me.
Right.
You knew this, right?
You were single for like a minute.
I was single for a minute, and that was the only minute, and still is the only minute in my entire life when I've been single.
Right.
I've been single for 1 minute.
Right. And that's
and that was it.
And
that
I
was
got
the
in
minute.
I got in there and you sacked it. But you had already like I think that you were like already like en route to being in your next much more serious and better relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh yeah. No, I think yeah, it was all sort of coterminous. It was all happening at the same time as I recall you and I doing our thing and then this new relationship was happening. So I may have been single for like half a minute actually.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, so we had this thing and then I hurt you because then I,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I had to block you for a while.
I know. You couldn't talk to me for about 6 months.
Yeah.
Right?
I was
a 6 month hiatus.
I was mad and I was hurt. But then I stopped being as mad and as hurt and we became like Facebook friends again and actually like returned to like our original state, which was like political friends, kind mm-hmm. of like probably one of the more interesting Facebook pages that I
oh,
know. and like I need that too actually, you know, and like it's sort of like, you know, every the and I'm very excited to also like to sort of see behind the curtain of like that Facebook persona.
Yeah. Oh, so by the way, I don't know.
He's very skinny.
Oh, okay. And she's very small.
Skinny guy.
Like very small. Do people know that we're sitting in my house in Salem, Oregon? Did I say that? I didn't say that, did I?
No.
Yeah. So that's another weird thing here. You're the first interview I've done in this house.
Where do you usually do it?
All over the country. I've been in Portland. I've been in Los Angeles, New York City. Yeah. You name it.
I also recently moved to Oregon.
So,
sorry, you're going.
Hang on. You're stealing my story. I know you're the amazing storyteller, but let me finish and then you can correct me.
Okay.
So yeah, we start talking about politics and that's really all I guess we've talked about personal stuff. The sexual part of our relationship disappeared entirely, as I recall, but we started talking about politics and you were very curious about my politics and I could see that your ideas were moving toward mine in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that was exciting to me. So I thought you were really cool for that reason. Super smart. But you were teaching creative writing at Kingsborough Community College.
I was teaching composition.
Composition.
So that actually, we assigned a lot of nonfiction. And then in the past few years, I've taught fiction.
Okay.
More.
But anyway, you were interested in politics and you had interesting ideas about politics, but you were not one of these political public intellectuals in my world, right?
Mm-hmm.
You were in the sort of intellectual world, but of the literary variety.
Mm-hmm.
And we're doing that kind of writing. And I thought that was cool, but I read some of that stuff, but you know, I'm not really of that world. So I'm telling you that I feel like an asshole because I kind of liked having you as a friend and I love talking about politics with you. And I have to say it was enjoyable to see you change your ideas according to mine. Not that you became a clone or anything, but just that I was having an influence on you politically.
No.
And also you were sort of in the belly of the beast. You were in Brooklyn and you had these ideas that you're not supposed to have in Brooklyn. And you were telling me about how you would go to parties with these hipsters and with their beards and you would tell them these ideas and they would freak out. And I loved that. And it felt like I had one person, you know, one mole was working for me in Brooklyn and you were it. So anyway,
it's hard to be a representative. People get very angry.
Oh, I know. Really? I've never noticed.
I can't handle it. Like I had to sort of stop arguing those points because people get too angry.
So we're definitely going to talk about that. So then you started writing short stories.
No, I'd been writing stories way before.
Sorry, you started writing a particular collection of short stories, right?
They'd been the stories I was working on. A lot of the stories, some of them. I've been working on stories. I went to grad school for fiction, from 2004 to 2006. And
you went to Columbia.
I went to Columbia mm-hmm. and began to take myself more seriously as a writer there. So, like, I think that my literary sort of life, like, I also like got the book deal in like 2014. The book didn't come out until 2016. So there was like all these sort of delays in terms of like when it became public that I had been doing this, but I had been doing it for a while.
Well, I became aware of your writing, I don't know, a few years ago. And I guess it, you had published them in literary magazines, and I read like a little snippet, and, you know, I knew that these were good literary magazines, and so I assumed you were a good writer, but I have to say I never really read much of you, so I just assumed this stuff. And then, you know, I moved to Salem, then you moved to Oregon, and mm-hmm. so I said, hey, let's have Rebecca on the podcast, because she's smart, and she has interesting political ideas, and she has this book out. So you get this book deal, and this is the other thing I'm embarrassed about. I was advising you. I was telling you how to be an author and how to get publicity and how to get
an
agent.
Was the publisher of the rent?
No, I know.
So it's we did have the same publisher. Yeah.
Well, but so anyway, the point I'm getting to is that the other thing I'm embarrassed about is that I didn't read your book until last night. And
you hated it.
I was sitting on my couch last night, and on the first page, I think it was two paragraphs into it, I laughed out loud. And I said, oh, wait a minute. This can't be. Am I just laughing because she's my friend? It can't be that good. Now, you had gotten all these amazing reviews. The New York Times, The Atlantic, The Nation, The New Yorker, Los Angeles Times, Oprah. People love this book. You were getting these rave reviews. And so I thought, well, she must be good. And this is the reason I wanted to have you on the podcast. Second page, I'm laughing out loud again. And then I'm feeling sad on the third page. And then I'm laughing out loud again on the fourth page. And then on the fifth page, there's this incredible political insight. And it just keeps going. And the prose is so crisp and economical and to the point and
Thank
direct.
You.
It's stunning.
Thank
it's
you.
It's brilliant. It's totally brilliant. And I felt humbled. And I felt like, you asshole, you should have been reading this a long time ago, and you should have been reading books like this instead of all these political texts and texts about history and philosophy. Because when I read books like yours, that's what I think. I think, what am I doing with my life? Why aren't I reading short stories and fiction more? Because these people are smarter than I am. They are. Novelists, I believe, are the smartest people on earth. And you're not technically a novelist, but you are a fiction writer. It's the same thing, essentially. I think you're smarter than all of us in who work in politics. I do.
I mean, on the one hand, I agree. And like, that's why I'm
good.
I like think fiction is the best thing. And I, you know, and the thoughts that go into it. And like, I'm like, yeah, it is. Everyone should be reading fiction and seeing that is how it, when I was a kid and I was a reader, that's like what helped me understand the world. And it's still like where I return to. At the same time, If you follow any of these fiction writers on, you know, on Twitter or social media, you'll see they have sometimes really boring politics.
I know.
You know, and that's always an interesting like sort of like division where like you know, someone who is writing this book that's so radical in a lot of ways, you know, so I just read this book called Afterbirth by this woman Elisa Albert, which is a very brutal, honest thing about like what it's like to have a baby and be a woman and like just kind of like she does not holding anything back, you know. I actually don't know what her politics are like on Facebook, but like just thinking about like someone could do that and then still have sort of just kind of like run of the mill
and think that Hillary is great.
Yeah, like I definitely like know a few like not they're usually not as like usually not as worshipful.
Think that Bernie's great.
Sometimes they like Bernie. I'm like they're less like into that. They're more like, what are we going to do? Like they feel very upset. Like mm-hmm. It's more like,
is it that they're part of the religion, the religious thinking that goes on the left, right? And there's good and evil and those are the good people or we're the good people and those are the bad people and
right.
We must fight the bad. And
I mean,
it's that kind of thing.
Not when you read what they're writing.
No, I know.
But like, I think that's also just sort of the polite kind of way to be socially maybe, and that you know
that's interesting.
A fiction writer the book may be the one place where they can like where they can be less polite, you know. Mm-hmm. And I certainly, you know, I think that because of you and probably Jonathan Cutler, I got like steered in a different direction early on, which I guess is a good thing about Wesleyan. In a way, and so I always had like a little bit of an extra, like I remember they were boycotting sushi in the campus center when I was there because it was like taking jobs away from the people who serve like the food, And I remember I was like secret. I was eating the sushi in the bathroom. I was like secretly eating the sushi, and I was like, I don't like this because I can't have something I like. You know, I can't have something I enjoy having. And we're all like punishing ourselves as a political action, or like there was like a hunger strike or something. And I was like, no, I don't think I would do well with that. You know, and so I like this idea that you could have politics that were more, that were pleasurable, and that you could still actually be like,
or that the politics of pleasure could be a good thing,
right? The politics of pleasure, and that a boycott and withholding something that from yourself is actually like a politics itself.
Whereas the left nowadays is animated almost entirely by a politics of anti-pleasure,
right?
Or a politics against pleasure,
right?
That there's guilt about pleasure,
right? Fear of pleasure.
So the rich are terrible because they have all this pleasure that we don't have, and the poor don't have.
Right.
But they don't want the poor to have the pleasure either, because what they hate popular culture very, very much. They hate what the poor do with their leisure time and how they spend their money. They hate that they go to those stupid movies, and they hate that they spend their money on brand names on their t-shirts, and they hate the TV shows they watch, and they hate a lot of the music they listen to. And so there's a problem with pleasure on the left that you had a problem with, because you like pleasure. And you liked a lot of kinds of pleasure, and you liked sexual pleasure. And that's the theme of this brilliant book you wrote, or it's one theme, I would say. So you liked sex.
I still do.
You still like sex. You like it a lot. You've had a lot of sex with a lot of men. Most of them, I think, have had beards. Is that correct?
No, not all of them. I mean, that's like
75%.
No, bearded? It's not that stereotypical.
At least 60.
I like beards. My current boyfriend is not bearded. So.
Oh, well, he's not in Brooklyn.
He was. That's where we met. Oh. That's where I met him. Yeah. Right. Now he moved to Oregon to do this. But yeah, I think the narrators in the book I think the LA Times reviewed it with two other books and called it slut lit. And that was like, that's been a question I get now at every reading I've done, which is like, how do you feel about that term? And of course, like, I love it. Mm-hmm. I think it's like really, I was very tickled by that, by when they did that. And I think, but what's complicated because it's fiction is that like the narrator and human beings, like casual sex is complicated, and it's not, it's pleasurable, but it's also like, it also can be sad or lonely. And I think like, that's like, that's sort of where, like, you know, actually the first story in the book, which is called the story itself is called The Bed Moved. I remember I had a therapist, and I was young. I was like 22, 23 maybe. And I was starting to have a lot of more casual sex. Like, I lost my virginity late, which is why I had to catch up.
How old were you?
I was 21.
Right. That is late.
Yeah, you were like 14 or something?
No. I was 19. I was late, too.
You were late? Oh, yeah. I thought you were early. Mm-mm, I thought you were like early.
Okay. I was late to everything. I didn't reach puberty until I was 17.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah, that can be very
painful. So we were both late bloomers?
Late bloomers, right. So I was like catching up, and I was telling the therapist about, like, I don't know, my escapades. And he was like this sort of like older, like Freudian guy. And he was just like, you know, you're like, but I guess he was just sort of like, yeah, you're preventing yourself from you're stopping yourself from having like a love and a real connection. And I was like, I sort of almost wrote the story like later, like arguing with him in my mind. Huh. Like it was valuable, or it was fun. And, but of course it was also, there's also some truth that isn't my politics, which is like go for the pleasure, which some truth is that, like, I remember once being on, like an OkCupid date, and the guy was like, sort of like bemoaning the fact that he wasn't like getting a girlfriend, but then he tried to have sex right away, like on the first day. And I was like, your strategy is like interesting, like that you're trying to have sex on the first date, but you want a girlfriend. And like, there's still something where there are couples who have sex on their first date and last forever. Like, you know, Dan Savage and his boyfriend, like they start as a one night stand. They're also gay men, so they might not have as much shame about that. But that there's this idea that if you care, you're going to wait. You know, or at least, I mean, by waiting, I mean like 2 days or 3 days instead of like the first night.
So you never had a long-term relationship, is that right?
No, that's not true. I had a couple of...
How long?
They were not that long. The longest one... Okay, so when I was 24, I had a relationship that lasted 5 months. And then when I was 34, I had a relationship that lasted a year.
Yeah, see, that's not long.
Those aren't that long. No. So I had a lot of time also to rack up to get the numbers up.
The shortest relationship I've had since I was 19 years old was 9 months, but I've had almost every relationship has been at least 3 years long.
Well, you're a serial monogamist.
I know. I'm a serial monogamist loser. And it's my one regret, especially about my college years, is that I wasn't promiscuous. I wasn't at all. And I should have been, and I could have been. And it was really a great regret of mine, but you were promiscuous. You were a slut.
Yeah.
Right.
I was,
you remained a slut into your 20s and 30s.
Yeah.
You're not anymore.
Well, now now
you're reformed.
No, I'm in a long term. Now I'm in my longest relationship, which is like a year and a month or something.
Totally sold out.
I've sold out. But I'm happier, actually. To be honest. Yeah.
I don't know what to do, Rebecca. I really don't. The relationship thing, we need to talk about this because I don't get it. It's too hard. I don't understand, but I can't imagine being not in a relationship, but it's ridiculous. So I'm old, I'm 51. I've been in many, many relationships. I'm a total veteran of this stuff. I've seen enough to know.
Yeah.
And basically it's just so hard. I can't believe it. And it's funny. It's like the problems cross class, cross race, cross geography. You know, when I'm hanging out with like MMA fighters at my gym, Walmart.
Right.
And they're talking about their relationships almost in exactly the same way that I talk about mine.
And what is that?
That they're just screaming at each other and that they don't understand women and their girlfriend is mad at them all the time and they can't figure it out and they can't communicate and their girlfriend thinks differently than they do. They're interested in things. The girlfriend's interested in relationships. The girlfriend wants them to text all the time. They don't. They think they're doing everything just fine and they show up and she's pissed off. It's all the same story.
Are you interested in things more than like relating and talking?
Gosh, I think for a man, I'm less like that than most. Certainly. That's the kind of what's going on in this podcast. Not just this episode, but the podcast in general.
You seem interested in like feelings.
Yeah. And I'm interested in both a lot, I guess.
But relationships are still hard.
Yeah, that's my point. I'm with the greatest woman I've ever met.
Yeah.
No doubt about it. Like by far, she's like way above everyone else I've known. No offense.
Okay,
but I didn't really know you until now anyway. But, and it's just so hard. That's what's shocking to me. It's like, if it's this hard with her, how could it ever work with anyone?
Right.
In the storybook way, in the Hollywood way, in the short story way. Well, not your short stories, but
not literary fiction where nothing works and everyone has affairs and is unhappy.
Right. So if you read, especially American fiction, if you know anything about American fiction and the history of it, it is so dark and so cynical.
Yeah.
And I have to say, your work, I think, is in the top tier of American literature in quality, but it also belongs in that category, in that tradition of, I think, is it fair to call it cynical?
Sure.
About love and sex and all this?
It's very cynical.
It's pretty dark.
It's pretty dark. I mean, in some ways it's darker than I am in a certain way. Like I think it comes from that place of darkness and cynicism and kind of the hopelessness of connecting and the hopelessness of like, you know, the loneliness of just like being human and knowing other humans. And I think in my life, I'm more hopeful about, I mean, I think there's ways that relationships and friendships and all that stuff can be very frustrating. I still believe, I guess.
Clearly. You're trying what we've all been trying.
Right. I'm trying it. Right.
And you're 38?
I'm 38.
And this is your longest relationship ever.
Yeah. It's kind of like I sort of want to give some like hope to any listeners who are like, who feel like it's never.
That was your Oprah moment, by the way, right there.
that no, because I was so slow and I was just like, what the hell? Like people are getting married, they're having babies, they're doing all this stuff. And like, I'm just like still like sucking dick in Brooklyn, you know, this is so and it was kind of, like in some ways I felt like superior, like look at all them with their dumb like wedding registries or whatever. And I still have mixed feelings about getting married, actually.
Weddings are terrible.
Yeah, they're terrible. They're
horrible. And you have some devastating stories about weddings. There's one in particular in your book that's just incredible.
Against Violence?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh my God, that's the greatest story ever. There's so much in that story.
I thought you might like that one.
Oh man. It's just an incredible critique of weddings and campus politics and sort of left politics generally. And oh man, is it good? Everyone should read that immediately. It's called Men Against Violence.
It's and, on and everybody listening, website.
Everybody listening probably already has a sense of what it's about. those guys who formed the group at their college, you know, against violence.
Yeah.
Against women. But they're the meekest people.
And right. And then they were the meekest.
And then there's the lesbian. Then there's the lesbian who's, comes and crashes their meeting and yells at them and makes them feel bad because they're violent, misogynist, patriarchal pieces of shit. And then she ends up beating up her girlfriend.
Yeah. In the story, she ends up beating up her girlfriend. Actually, a lesbian who is an alum came up to me at a wedding and was like, is that based on me? And I was like, no, it's actually based on a different lesbian.
the other lesbian.
She was like, I went to their meeting too. I did that too. And I was like, I had no idea. I had no idea you also did that. And so it was funny. She was like, I have to know if it's based on me. Cause I like scolded them, for like not including women. And there are all these groups like that. I've also heard of like groups of white people getting together to talk about their racism, which is like, which is like a sort of a similar trope as like men talking. And I believe at the time I believed that the Men Against, in the story, at least the narrator believes the Men Against Violence group is about sort of like kind of anti-porn, but also anti-domestic violence, kind of mixed, sort of like mushing them together. And this
everything gets mushed together. That's kind of the argument I think you're making implicitly in that story. Right. It's about violence, right?
Right.
And you make that amazing, beautiful point at the end of the story. I think it's the same story about violence and the woman who was actually killed at Wesleyan.
There was a woman actually killed.
Who was actually killed.
By a guy who was stalking her.
Yeah. And you have this line at the end. I can't remember it exactly, but it's something about when it's real violence. Do you remember the line?
Violence. I know violence has to mean what it says, and it shuts everyone up when it says it.
Yeah.
That was, I think, the last.
Yeah.
I memorized the whole book.
No, I mean, it's genius. You know, it's sort of like, because you make the point in the story, and everybody who's been on a college campus knows this, that on college campus, all sorts of things get conflated with physical violence, right?
Right.
Which is this perversion of this postmodern idea that language is power.
Right.
That discourse is power. Mm. So Foucault and company certainly did make that argument, but they wouldn't ever say, I don't think, that that kind of violence is identical to physical violence, that there is no distinction to be made between the two.
Right, right, right.
And well, that's what goes on college campuses these days. So people say, your words are killing me.
Right.
You know, your thoughts, your ideas are killing me. And that's the word they use. We are endangered. And they talk about it as if they're in physical danger when there's not been one act of, you know, a real violent hate crime on a college campus in like 30 years.
Right.
Not one.
What was interesting about the girl in the story that she's murdered and like almost like the campus, it almost like is almost like making it equal to everything else is pretty like not very, I thought really like not respectful of her death in
exactly.
a way, or the fact that the guy had lost his, so the guy who killed her had like sort of was, had gone, you know, and there's the question of like, was he influenced by like, you know, the idea that men can have a right to women's attention and you know, that question is certainly there, but like he had like lost his marbles and he became homicidal, you know, which sort of reminds me of what happened in Portland like last week, which is like that guy was homicidal and people miscalculated or misjudged.
A homicidal psychotic.
Right. He was a homicidal psychotic.
Who had some of the things he said overlapped with some white supremacist language. But what people immediately did was he's just a white supremacist. And that's all this was. That's what this was. This was an act of white supremacy. And that's who this guy is.
Right.
And if you spend 1 second looking, there's all sorts of videos of him at these marches with Trump people. And the Trump people are like, in the videos are saying, we're not with this guy. He's crazy. We have nothing to do with this dude. And he's marching around. He's clearly incoherent and he's babbling.
Right.
But it has to be about white supremacy.
Also, like people need to identify, like, and this also, I was thinking about New York, like people, I think, and this is a challenging thing to do, but I think like to be able to tell the difference between homicidal psychosis and other kinds of speech might be a useful tool if you're walking around in the world and like
I mean sure there is, the words do hurt, of course, yeah, right? But it's a different kind of hurt. It's a different category of hurt in the world that we live in.
Right.
I think Foucault and the postmodernists would say that in the world that we live in, right, which is our own constructed world, but that's the one we live in and he lived in.
Yeah.
Words hurt in a particular way.
Right.
Axes in the head hurt in a different way.
Yeah.
And to conflate the two actually does damage, or you could say it does violence to the idea of violence. And that was kind of what I read in your story, because you very powerfully end that story with, this is what real violence does. It really shuts up people. It really stops people from talking. It really eliminates them and their words.
Right.
Like that woman who was actually dead.
Right. Yeah. It's I feel sad about it.
Yeah. So you're from, so this is, you were at Wesleyan, which is kind of like the epicenter of a lot of this stuff on college campuses, right?
Yeah. And it was like, I mean, I was there from 97 to 2001. And there was already, there were like safe spaces and,
that was before the big explosion of PC on campuses.
I mean, PCU was even before my time. So I guess,
there were two phases. A lot of people don't know this. I'm old enough to know about the history of this. So the first sort of eruption of PC was in the early 90s and the date rape hysteria began then. There was a date rape thing then. And then Katie Royfe wrote her great book debunking that. And then it didn't go away entirely, of course, but in the mid 90s and late 90s, there was much less of this going on campuses. And then there was this explosion in the last like 5 years.
Right.
First with the sexual assault stuff and then with the race stuff on campuses. And this is kind of like the peak of PC-dom on campuses right now.
Right. It's not, it was,
but there was a lull when you were.
The lull, but Wesleyan was keeping the flame alive. like the lull was like, it was like, we're going to like, let this like, just like keep like the like eternal flame. Mm-hmm. Like we're going to keep it lit during this lull, because I was definitely there like, God bless them. And I went to five Take Back the Night marches, because I went to one as a pre-frosh too.
Oh.
Like that was my visit to the campus. I went to four Take Back the Night marches before I ever had sex at all.
Wow.
I lost my virginity post Take Back the Night, and I was super confused, because I was like, I was hooking up with people, and I was like, I've like never been raped or assaulted. Like this is really. I felt kind of guilty. I was walking around like chanting, and then also thinking about pleasure and how much consensual sex is happening on this campus, not enough, was also a complaint going around at the same time, that there wasn't enough consensual sex happening, and like people were frustrated.
Or that there was non-consensual sex happening, or there just wasn't enough sex happening.
There wasn't enough sex was a complaint.
Right.
And part of the reason there wasn't enough sex was, I think, because a lot of the straight men, at least, were very shy and were afraid a little bit. Not just politically afraid, but like actually afraid of women and like to touch them and stuff. And then there were
really
actually afraid to like make a move or do anything. Like it was unlike other sort of more, what I think of as more regular college campuses in that way. But it was where they're probably, I don't know what the statistics are, but I'm guessing there's more date rape on a campus that has more sex, just because like, you know,
I mean, of course, it all depends on how you define date rape,
acquaintance rape, or what's going on.
What you're saying is there wasn't, not only there was no or little acquaintance rape at Wesleyan when you were there, but there was just no sex going on at Wesleyan, or very little.
Right. I mean, there was some acquaintance rape and some sex, it was a place that things happened at. But I think that the proportion, it was a disproportionate, at the time, I felt that it was a disproportionate focus on the non-consensual sex that was... That was happening.
So that was late 90s. I was in college in the mid 80s, mid and late 80s at Antioch in Ohio. And my God, everybody was fucking at Antioch. There was just sex all over the place all the time. Yeah. I mean, pretty much everyone hooked up at Antioch.
Except you.
No. I was hooking up, but just with the same person
and
over again.
Oh.
So I mean, there was lots of sex. I was having lots of sex, but it was the same person.
Well, that's the thing also about being in a relationship, is you actually wind up having more sex in a certain way.
And better sex
than if you're hooking up with a lot of different people who are just, where you're starting over every time.
Yeah, this is generally true. Yes, I think.
but not for some people, maybe not. Like maybe some people, the variety is the excitement and the newness.
But when
fun.
When I hear that people in college are not having sex, I mean, I just think that's one of the greatest tragedies of all time. When I ask my students, I don't know if you know what's going on now on college campuses, in addition to the PC stuff, I would say an even worse thing that's happening is that there's no more fun on college campuses because there's all these very strict regulations. There's no drinking at all allowed. Mm. They don't allow any alcohol on the campus. There are no parties on the campus anymore because of liability.
I should look at U of Oregon. I see them buying beer all the time.
But they take it off campus.
Oh, okay.
They go to houses off campus or they go to apartments off campus. Oh. There's nothing going on campus. Whereas in my college, and I think at other colleges, we were partying on campus in our dorm rooms with beer, with whiskey, right. with weed, with whatever, naked, having sex, doing the whole thing. It was amazing. It was the greatest thing ever. It was heaven, except when we lost our minds and had PC, you know, witch hunts. But fortunately, there was much more of the naked hippie running around smoking weed.
That was Wesleyan too. There was naked weed stuff. There was a naked party I went to.
But not a lot of sex though.
Not for me. Maybe other people.
Everybody hooked up in my college.
Right.
Everybody.
There was I remember actually this was a big moment for me where I wrote an anti-porn op-ed.
Oh, good.
And then when I was
you
wrote, me personally, and then when I was a junior, I wrote.
Is that still available online?
I used to actually have to tell people like my views have changed, even though you can find that online, but you can't find it anymore. It was in the.
What was your argument against porn?
It was super boring. It was like a very second wave, like sort of just like it was like those women are people. We see them as objects. Like it was pretty. Like I actually should have written. My views had changed writing the article. My views changed because I started to actually watch porn to research the article. Uh-huh. And that was when I was like, oh wait, I'm actually like, I just watch porn. So maybe I should like correct that. But I was too embarrassed almost to write like a correction. Like now I think porn is okay. Like
you were anti-porn and you watched porn to research
my anti-porn
and then got turned on by it.
Yeah, I got turned on the porn. And I started I started watching porn like a person. And we also had our computers in our dorm rooms for the first time. It was like, this was 97.
Danger.
So I could, I think a lot of women actually began to watch more porn because they didn't have to go into the store and buy it and like face the weird guy, the weird dude or the judgment in the store. So that's like a,
do we know the numbers on this? I'm curious. What do you think? What percentage of women consume porn? There must be numbers somewhere.
I have no idea what the numbers are.
Pornhub Analytics, I'm sure, has a page on this.
I mean,
an amazing site, by the way. Have you ever gone to Pornhub Analytics?
No, but I should. I would like to.
They do all this research on porn consumption globally. It's awesome.
Oh, yeah. I think I did actually read some analytics recently, which was really, had some things that surprised me.
Yeah.
Like globally, right? That like some countries are like really into blowjobs and some countries are like totally not.
Exactly.
Like, there's a.
And then the really cool stuff that I've been studying or thinking about a lot lately is trends and subgenres of porn. Mm. So one of the fastest growing trends and subgenres in porn in the recent years is BBW, Big Beautiful Women.
Oh, okay.
And we're talking women who are more than 200 pounds. We're not.
Wow.
When they say big, they're not playing around.
Well, that's like, fighting some other thing in the culture.
I know. Like, and these are stars. These are women who get, you know, a million or 2 million views of every video they do. That this is their sole income. Mm. They are big stars. And a lot of beautiful stars. A lot of us like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, so Pornhub tracks this. Everyone should go to Pornhub Analytics. And I want a campaign to make Pornhub Analytics into like one of the go-to sites for our information. So you wrote this op-ed for the Wesleyan Argus, I take it?
Yeah.
The infamous Wesleyan Argus.
Westspeak is what they're called.
Westspeak?
Oh, like W-E-S, then speak, the word speak. Everything at Wesleyan has to have West in front of it, so Westspeak.
Oh, I thought it was the Argus.
No. The Argus is the newspaper, but the op-eds are called Westspeak.
Gotcha.
Like you speak.
So the Argus recently was like a year ago when they banned or they defunded the Argus because someone wrote...
I wrote a letter
that
got tracked.
Some guy at Wesleyan wrote an op-ed that was just simply critical of Black Lives Matter.
Yeah.
And, you know, with... You didn't have to agree with it, but it was just rational arguments against Black Lives Matter, or really, it was pretty soft, actually.
It was soft.
There was no name calling or anything like that, and certainly nothing racist in it. But they defunded the newspaper because of that.
They funded it. Now it comes out once a week. It used to come out twice a week.
Yeah.
So they
cut the funding.
And I wrote and the Argus also, the editorial board wrote an apology, which I found
that's
freaky.
Worse. Yeah.
What?
That's worse than cutting the funding.
Yeah, that part was worse. So I wrote a letter, which actually was picked up by a conservative. I wrote a letter being like, I'm like in support of Black Lives Matter, but you guys are a newspaper. Don't ever apologize for printing anything. I was an editor on the Argus. I was a features editor. Or maybe I was the opinions editor. I can't even remember now. It shouldn't have come out twice a week. It was too much for the paper. So then part of me thinks like it's okay that it comes out once a week because it was a small campus. But the principle of it, I don't agree with.
Apologizing for printing ideas.
Yeah. Yeah. I was.
That's all it was.
It freaked me out. I did not like that. And I sort of wanted to like go there and like talk to them because, you know, it's my newspaper.
Good luck. It's rough out there. I think the ship is sinking.
Well, this is my question for you.
Yeah.
On like an emotional level.
Sure.
Like, you know, you're out there saying this kind of stuff and people, I see that there's like opposition and I had to like back off because I just couldn't take it. Like I couldn't take every time, like I put something, you know, now I sort of do an opinion in like a way that doesn't make people as mad anymore. I just kind of like make it, but I just couldn't take it because I'd spend the whole day arguing with people on a thread. Like I didn't have any self-control about that. And I wonder, like, do you think it affects you to be arguing all the time with people who are like not budging?
Yeah, it ruins my life.
Okay.
No, I'm not kidding.
Have you thought about?
Yeah.
Like,
so I stopped doing it.
But you still post like.
I post stuff. But I don't argue with people.
You don't argue, right? Yeah. So you just let the argument happen.
Occasionally, I will argue in a sustained way with someone on Twitter,
right?
Only if they're famous.
So that's just
to take them down. So I've done that with David Simon, the creator of The Wire.
I know about
twice,
that. Yeah,
and I made him block me because I destroyed him.
That's an example, right, of where the art is. The art has a different message than the person. Like the show, The Wire,
yeah.
I think.
Well, yes.
In a certain way, with some exceptions.
David Simon is all about Franklin Roosevelt and bringing the New Deal back. He loves the New Deal and thinks we need a New Deal.
Right, right.
And he thinks that's just awesome what the New Deal was. And so government programs for this, that, and the other thing. Not knowing really anything clearly about the history of the New Deal.
The show is so cynical about government.
Of course. Right. So he doesn't see his own contradictions. This is
right.
This is correct. I agree with you. The Wire is certainly, if you watch The Wire, you don't come away with it thinking, gosh, we need more government.
Right. And like,
well, you see,
Carchetti is like fake, you know.
Yeah, you
like,
see corrupt politicians, you see corrupt cops, you see police violence, you see stupid incarceration, you see the drug war, which he's sort of good on the drug war, although he thinks he's so goddamn dumb. And I hope he's listening. He thinks this was one of the arguments we had. He insisted on this. He thinks the drug war and mass incarceration is driven entirely by the private prisons.
Right.
By the profit motive. And I pointed out that right now, 6% of prisoners in the United States are in private prisons and that the prison guard lobbies are about 100 times bigger than the private prison lobbies.
Right.
It didn't matter. He just kept going. And finally, I just, you know, I'd come up with evidence, statistic, right, in response to him. He would just start yelling at me on Twitter. You know, you can actually yell on Twitter, all caps. And then he starts calling me names and ad hominem.
Private prison, because I also know, like, people who are, like, anti-prison, who are almost, I think that's a fear, is to be anti-prison, just anti-prison. So so it becomes, like, anti-private prison, which is.
They're not anti-prison, they're anti-private. They're anti-profit.
Right. Well. Right, they're anti.
That's what bugs them.
So it becomes anti-profit when really it should just. What's wrong with being anti-prison? Like that feels like.
What I think that whole thing is, because that's much the left. It's not just David Simon.
Yeah,
they think the private prisons are the real problem in driving this whole thing. What it reveals is that they don't actually care that much about incarceration.
Mm.
What they really care about is people making money. They really hate when people make money.
Right.
They really hate profit, and that's what drives them crazy. because it makes no, it's utterly irrational. So if you look at Mother Jones's top 10 list every year, they come up with a list of the worst prisons in the United States.
Yeah.
They've done this for about 5 years running. Every year, almost everyone, almost every prison on that list is a public government run prison.
Right.
Think about it. Angola in Louisiana, Attica in New York,
right.
San Quentin in California, Supermax in California, in Colorado, Pelican Bay in California. The these are like the worst dungeons ever invented by human beings. Every single one of those run entirely by the state.
See, I think I'm when I think about like what's that people don't like, I think that some people on the left, I think this is where the confusion is. I think some people on the left care about, or just are upset about profit. But I think that some of it is just the habit, like, I don't know what to call it, the habit of like checking that box, almost, because I think some people are truly bothered by prisons, but have to like, then, like, I have a friend who's a very compassionate person. And I think like, she would probably like, if like, she would cry, you know, she would cry if she saw what was going on in a prison, like, but she will focus on the private prison aspect because that's the discourse.
Mm-hmm.
So she's not exactly running the discourse, but she's like, when she goes into the discourse, that's the language, or that's the thing that's there.
That's what's available.
That's what's available. Hmm. So I think that like some people, and I think this drives me crazy, I think that some people have a more vested interest in keeping the discourse there because they actually want government to be bigger or have more power.
Yeah, they want prisons.
They want prisons.
They want prisons to put all the people who don't pay their taxes in.
Right. And some people who aren't thinking as
they don't think, no one thinks about that. What are you going to, you know, they're all for taxes and government programs. Right, well, what if you don't want to pay your taxes?
Right.
What if you don't want to join this government program? Oh, by the way, they're also all for, many of them are for the draft, right? Because that is actually a democratic system.
Well, that was like, that's a fascinating
thing. So if you don't want to be drafted, you're going to go to prison. Well, so the left needs prisons, always has.
Fair enough. But I think that what I'm saying is that the left, that there's like, I think that more people who might be open to your argument, I mean, you know, more people on the left who might be open to your argument because they're not as invested in, they might just be picking up this discourse, but not be as invested in maintaining it. And you find out the difference when you present like an idea.
Yeah. Well, the problem to me with the left, maybe the central problem these days, it hasn't always had this problem,
right?
Is that there is no analysis of the state anymore. There's no understanding of the state. There's hardly any leftists anymore who have a real analysis of the state, or an understanding that it is the monopoly on violence. This is Max Weber's old formulation from the early 20th century that we all used to know about, and we used to teach this in colleges, and that's what it still is. The state is the legitimate monopoly on legitimate violence, right? The state can use violence whenever it wants.
Mm-hmm.
We can't unless we're licensed by the state, allowed by the state to use violence. So it can kill us. We can't kill people unless we are allowed by the state to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So they also don't acknowledge, I think it's just sort of a willful ignorance, that every single law is backed up by that threat, by the threat of that violence.
Right.
Otherwise it's meaningless as a law. So every tax, everything, every parking ticket, you know, if you don't pay your parking ticket, you get fined. If you don't pay the fine, you get a notice, and then you get 10 notices, and then they come and arrest you.
There was something interesting when the travel ban was going on, where they were like, some of the ICE guys in the airports, or I don't know what they're called, were like not listening to the judge. Mm-hmm. Right. They were like, I answer to Donald Trump. And then, during the first visa ban.
Mm-hmm.
And then someone was like, I think it was Glenn Greenwald, was like, send in the marshals. But then they were like, we're not going to listen to the marshals either. And I was like, fuck, wait. I was like, oh my God, if they don't listen to the marshals, then like, the law is like, is not backed up. Or then the marshal was like, I'm not going to enforce the judge's order.
Right.
Right. And then so I was thinking about the state then at that moment. And I was like, oh my God, wait, maybe I want checks and balances. I don't know. I'm so confused right now. Like I want like at least the state power to be like spread out, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what you're saying is even deeper, which is that even if it's spread out, it's still like
it's still the monopoly. It's still prisons. It's still cops killing people, or at least threatening to kill people. Otherwise, there ain't no laws. the laws are meaningless.
Right.
Right. Unless you actually put people in prison.
Right.
And threaten to use the gun if they don't comply with the law. Right.
Right.
The visa ban thing, we can do this quickly, but like the thing there is it was the executive versus the legislative, essentially.
Yeah.
Right. And so
right. And the judicial.
If you're an anti-statist like me, then it's all bad.
Right.
Or it's all, at least all problematic,
right.
But the executive is worse because it's one guy.
Right.
Who controls it.
Right.
That wing of the monopoly on violence.
Mm-hmm.
So Trump can, as we speak, kill a million people, you know, in this moment. He can press a button almost literally and kill a million people.
Right, right.
He can deploy the military anytime he wants. Congress, fortunately, takes a lot longer. It's much harder for them to do stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They can do stuff equally bad, but it just takes longer. So generally speaking, our preference is for it to be in the legislative, right?
Yes, I see the. I think that I became afraid for like a few days, and this was.
Wasn't it something? There was such hysteria.
Yeah,
people were really freaking out.
I was one of them. I was freaking out. I was susceptible. Yeah, I was like.
I mean, even I was for about a minute and a half.
And then you stopped.
Nervous? No. Then I did some research.
Yeah.
And actually read, because foreign policy was the whole thing for me. I knew he wasn't going to get anything accomplished in domestic policy.
Right.
But foreign policy, he could, as I've said, he can go kill a bunch of people anytime he wants. So I just read up on him very quickly, election night, because I had not, like everyone else, I had assumed he was going to lose. And then when he won,
right.
I immediately went to Google and I researched all of his foreign policy advisors and found that most of them, certainly at that time, were essentially non-interventionist except on radical Islam.
Mm-hmm.
So they were going to go hard in the Middle East and kill ISIS, stupid, which would just bring more blowback and terrible.
Right.
But otherwise, they were for pulling out of NATO. They were for no regime change. They were for no global policeman,
right?
You know, which was this overturning of 100 years of globalism, right? Which the Democrats invented, and it's really been their thing, but the Republicans bought into it as well.
Mm.
So that I said to everybody on social media, and you probably saw this, you know, and I wrote an article about it and I did some interviews about it, you know, these guys suck.
Right.
Generally, in most ways. And on the Middle East, they're going to be terrible. They're going to kill a bunch of people. But they're saying for the first time.
I read the article.
Yeah. That that the United States doesn't and shouldn't be the global policeman. And
what
we
about now? What happened?
Then
now?
The generals took over.
The generals
took
over.
Kicked out. So Bannon got demoted. Miller got demoted. And McMaster. And
well, that was a case.
Jim Mattis have taken over.
That's a case where like everyone was focusing on how bad Bannon was. And I was like, oh no, you guys. Like internet, like partly because of your article, but like internationally, you're actually rooting for something worse.
Yeah. The CIA became the heroes.
Right.
Amazing.
That was amazing.
Yeah. The liberals are just really incredible. All right. Back to your book. Enough of this.
We could spend all day on the liberals. Yeah. yeah.
So yeah, your book, first of all, it is hilarious.
Thank you.
It's so funny.
Thanks.
Yeah, no, I mean, that I have to say, that did surprise me. The stereotype about women not being funny, right?
Yeah, sure. So I know it's about it.
And it's not entirely untrue, that stereotype.
It depends on the woman.
Well, of course. Well, that's right. But the stereotype.
Stereotype has
so
some.
But in general, right, that's the feminine. It's not considered to be ladylike. Being funny is a form of aggression.
That's true.
And so you're not supposed to do that as a woman. It's not that women don't have the ability.
Right.
It's that they are not allowed to.
Well, actually, Philip Roth, who we were talking about a little bit before the podcast, has one of like the famous, I don't know if you've heard of Grace Paley.
But sure.
His blurb on the back of like her book, which is like delightfully unladylike.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Because she's being funny and she's being sexual. And
what do we say about women who are really funny the way dudes are? What do we call them? Bitches.
Bitches, yeah.
Right?
I mean, that's loud.
Yeah, they're bitches.
Right.
I mean, they may be funny, but you're not supposed to do that. I mean, I think Sarah Silverman's got a lot of that. I think Amy Schumer's gotten a lot of that. Even though I'm not a big fan of their politics,
right.
I think they've been victims of that.
You should watch Ali Wong.
Hmm.
She's like the new. She's like, I don't want to work.
Really?
I want to like.
Oh, I like her.
I want my like husband to like take care of me, kind of, wow. Which is really interesting.
Right,
like,
on.
She's like, lean in. I want to lie down.
Wow.
Like, she's, yeah, you got to watch it.
That's my kind of feminism.
Except that, of course, like, in real life, I think she does work a lot and she, like, works sure. on her shows. And
we're
her,
all hypocrites.
Everyone's a hypocrite. But I do think that special, because she's also, like, a few years younger than me, I was like, it gave me a little hope. Hmm. I was like, oh, and, like, people, I feel like there's, also that she's a comedian, which means she's allowed to, there's more license, I think, to say something like that.
And but don't you think
she also did it 7 months pregnant?
But on gender, do you think I'm right? Like that women can't get away with as much as men can?
Of course not. Yeah, of course they can't get away with right. as much. I mean, I think there's like,
so it's kind of trained out of you, right? You're not allowed.
Yeah.
And that's why it's surprising to see a woman this funny.
Well, why it wasn't trained out of me, I'm curious about,
yeah,
you know,
me
and
too.
I think my mom's really funny.
Doesn't come across in the book at all.
The mom character?
Yeah.
Being funny? Yeah, that's fiction.
She seems not funny at all, in fact.
The mom is a little, like, I think that's one of the things the challenge is like making the authority, in my future of writing, is making the authority figures a little less, like, sort of like one note, because my mom is an authority figure to me because she's my mom, but like, she's also really funny and like, I don't think I'd be funny if she wasn't funny. My sister's really funny. And I also saw that, like, in my parents' relationship, that my mom could be funny and my dad, like, still, like, liked her, you know? And so that maybe gave me a sense of that it was a way to charm people or be in the world. And I think I'm more funny in the book, but I can be funny in real life eventually.
Eventually?
It takes a little time.
If we hang out long enough?
If we hang out long enough, I'll be funnier.
Well, I'm not kidding. I think it's pretty much every page I laughed out loud. I'm not kidding.
Wow.
And I really know I sound like I'm completely brown nosing, but it's really true. I was surprised that I was laughing that much at your book. It is really, really funny. And it's also heartbreaking all the way through at the same time. It's really something, you know, and then you have these insights about politics also on every single page. It's quite a combination. So you're hilarious. And then your mother is the most heartbreaking part of the book. To me anyway, there's these scenes where you're in the kitchen after your dad's died and you're just talking.
The character.
Okay. Sorry.
That's what we do in fiction. Yeah.
Sorry.
The characters in the
so
kitchen.
So it is, how do you characterize it? Is it fictional memoir or biographical fiction or what?
There's a term, autobiographical fiction, that I'm not a huge fan of. I think I'm just going with fiction.
Okay.
And allowing that fiction comes from personal places, mm-hmm. but that the license to make things up and to sort of like fictionalize things that happen is very, somehow I need that.
Okay. So how do I talk about these characters in your book now?
Just say the narrator or the character.
Okay. But is it not true that they're based pretty closely on?
My father died. Mm-hmm. But I may not have stood in the kitchen with my mother and had that scene.
Oh, sure.
Happen. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Sometimes like the emotions, I don't know, the emotions may be true, but like there's still a lot of like making up mm-hmm. going on, but you can talk about however you want.
Okay.
So if you want to talk about the scene without worrying about
so
that,
there are heartbreaking scenes in which the narrator is standing in the kitchen or just, you know, in the house with the mother after the father has died.
Yeah.
And what I see in these relationships in your book between the narrator, who looks a lot like you, seems a lot like you, and the mother, who I imagine is probably a lot like your mother and your father, or the character is a lot like your father. What happens a lot is that they talk about things in between them, or they talk about things sort of around them rather than talking about each other and about their relationships. Mm. So I said to you when we talked on the phone this morning that the word that comes to mind when I read your book is distance. There's distance between the characters. And that could either be geographical distance, like between you and me 5 years ago, or are the guys in your book who you dated, you know, either online or you just didn't have these real connections with.
Right. Or even if they're physically in the same place, they're like disconnected.
Exactly.
In some ways, the pot grower.
It seems like with the mother and father characters and the narrator character that there's lots of talk about stuff and things, and they're always busy doing things. They're always figuring out how to get a water filter for the sink, or how to work the word processor on the computer, or driving here and doing this and doing this errand, and they're not really engaging with each other. Does that sound right to you?
I think with fiction, I think if you have a scene where they're just like, I am so sad dad died, I too am sad, you know, which may be a scene that actually like takes place between me and my real mother, you know, where like, I'm sad, I miss daddy, me too. Like, you know, that's, it doesn't make, I think it doesn't make the fiction as interesting as the moments where it's there, but it's, but other things have to keep happening, you know, where like you're at a funeral for your own parent, but you're like, it's not really for you in a certain way, because like, I'm more interested in those moments of alienation or and of distance. Like, I think that they're like, they can be more painful or more funny. And so that's why I'm writing about them. But I think that, and of course, like there were, you know, there was loneliness, I think, in grief, like grieving is lonely. Like, I think even if you, cause everyone grieves differently and everyone is grieving when you lose a family member, everyone is grieving a different person to them, you know? So I think that was something that like, I don't know if you've had like, you know, a death in, but like there's a way that, you know, the person themselves is like just a stand in for all these other things that are lost.
So the death of your father is the theme throughout the short stories, right?
It's not in every one of them. At some point I like realized I was putting it like in too many stories. I was like, this story doesn't need a dad death. Like I'm going to like, and then they start being kind of more like just about like relationships, and there's not always a dead dad. At some point I tried to make there be like a dead brother just for like variety, it wasn't really working. So I just kept it like,
it's in a lot of them.
Yeah.
And it's a major theme.
It's a big theme in the book, and the loss of my father was a big deal to me. So I think like that writing was a way to like deal with it and process it. And now that it's further in the distance, I'm also sort of like, you know, that became like a challenge. Like, what am I going to write about now? Like the, like sort of like what else is there kind of, and it turns out there's plenty of pain in regular life too.
Indeed.
And plenty of funny pain, you know, like in dating and in, and also this stuff, because my dad died when I was about 21, actually died. This is back to the virginity loss, like died like maybe 3 months before I lost my virginity. So like those things were happening simultaneously. Like I was becoming an adult and living that life. And so that sort of mix is happening, I think, also particularly in
I was going to say, so that's the juxtaposition that is especially arresting about your book, is that there's sex and death together in almost every paragraph, right?
Yeah, they're.
And in fact, they come together very closely, and it's yet another stunning moment in the book when your father is just, sorry, the narrator's father has just died, and the narrator is going through his computer files, or the files in his hard drive in his computer, right?
Comes back to porn,
And she finds a porn video, correct?
Yeah.
Of, what was it? Two women boxing. They had big tits and they were boxing.
You must be interested because you like care. You actually know about boxing.
Yeah. Of course. Well, I was interested in it for two reasons. No.
They have big tits. Yeah. It's important.
Or four reasons in boxing. Anyway. So that's something, right? It's unsettling in the best way. Because of course the dead are supposed to be held with this reverence and they're supposed to be pure. In fact, I think you say that in the story. And here you are, and you have this amazing line about you wanted to go into the darkness that your dad was in. Something about the darkness that he was in, like, that you imagined he was in when he was searching out this porn, and you were trying to rationalize why he would look at porn when he was dying. He was dying of cancer at the time.
Yeah.
So why would he look at porn when he's dying of cancer? And you're trying to, the narrator is trying to rationalize this. Well, maybe he wanted to feel alive, or, you know, he wanted to feel something as he was on his way out. And it's just a stunning thing. I mean, to your courage in doing that, in talking about someone who might be your father who's dying of cancer and what him watching porn, right? You're not supposed to say that, Rebecca. You're not supposed to do that.
Dads don't watch porn.
Dead dads, especially
dead
don't watch
dads,
porn.
Yeah.
Porn.
Well, I know, but on the other hand, like if you find your live dad's porn, you can't write about it.
I guess that would be even worse. Maybe.
In a certain way. I mean, I think like parents,
Yeah. Parents can't be sexual.
Right. Parents can't be sexual. Or if they are, they're supposed to like hide it from you. And then they, if they're dead, they can't hide it. They don't, they can't, or they might not have the technical wherewithal to hide their, cover their tracks.
But you had the temerity.
Yeah.
To not only go searching and open that file and watch it to mm-hmm. find out that it was porn. Then you wrote about it and published it with Alfred A. Knopf.
Well,
what kind of a person would do that?
I'm a courageous person. I have a little chutzpah.
That's why you're here.
I think that on the one hand, yeah, I think like it was probably like, I think it was one of the first stories that I've written stories before that, but I think it was one of the first stories where I was brave enough to do something like that, you know, and I really liked that feeling because I knew that it made the story better. Like, and I was like, oh, this is making it so much better to be braver, you know, and I think that it makes politics better to be braver. It makes everything better, you know, like, so it definitely makes fiction better, like, to take risks, whatever they are for that particular writer. And for, you know, for me, that was a risky thing to feel or think about, but I'd rather go there and make, you know, I'd rather go there than not go there because I think it's more true. And it's funny because then later in the collection, there's a story where the narrator and her friend are considering making porn themselves. Mm-hmm. Like they're like, should we be in it? And they're having all these class sort of issues where they're like, we're nice girls from the suburbs. Like, how are we can't just be in this guy's porno, you know, like they're like, and they also, and they're kind of like also slumming it a little bit with this mm-hmm. kind of like,
Hipster porn.
It's like hipster. Well, it's like the guys are actually kind of like a hippie dirtbag is like the climbers call themselves that.
Yep.
Right. Dirtbag. And mm-hmm. he's a dirtbag. And like one of the girls sort of wants to be a dirtbag, but they're from this like nice town. And so it becomes this issue in the friendship. But anyway, I was thinking about those were years between when I wrote the Finding the Dad's Porn and the like, should we make porn? You know, and like, and as I was saying earlier, I had written that like anti-porn article. So obviously I was evolving with mm-hmm. with my writing and into almost like, this looks like a fun, like maybe a fun way to make money, but what's holding, like what holds everyone back from making money that way?
Yeah. Well, here's the thing about your dad. He was a human being.
Right.
Right?
Sure.
And human beings watch porn.
Well, I know that now.
In fact, human beings, we know this, human beings watch a lot of porn.
More than anything else they do, basically.
Pretty much. Yeah. We know this for sure. We have the numbers. No, it's true. I mean, yeah. The porn industry is just massive.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's what you were doing, I think.
Well, I think that's...
You were humanizing him. I don't like that word, but you were, right? I mean, you were...
I think that was sort of the funny part.
Dead people are human beings, too, or at least they were, and they are complicated people. That's right. The thing. They're not just these martyrs or saints.
Right. They're not martyrs or saints, and to make them into that is also like taking something away from them.
Exactly.
You know, which is their exactly. their humanity and their complicatedness and kind of to like give it back in a way to a dead person in some ways, like when I'm like being proud of myself instead of feeling guilty about, you know, about like exposing everyone's secrets, when I feel the opposite is like, actually like this was like to honor my dad in a way, you know?
Exactly. I agree with that. You honored your father in that way. You did something even bigger and better, I think. Which is that you attacked sexual shame.
Mm.
Because that's the whole issue, right? Is that we are ashamed of sex. And that's why porn, we hide from our daughters and we hide from the world. And
right,
if the daughter finds our porn, it's one of the worst things that could happen to us, right?
Right.
And so you, by doing this, by just exposing it, by just showing it in this sort of almost matter-of-fact way and talking about it in a matter-of-fact way, you are serving to reduce the shame. You're bringing it into the light.
Right.
And so the shame attached to porn is, of course, anti-sex.
Mm-hmm.
It imprisons us, that shame. That is the basis of the repression. And so what you do in that story and throughout your book is you just drive a truck right through that repression and you say, this is what we do. We fuck and we watch porn even when we're dead. Right? Even the dead people watch porn. Even the dead dads watch porn, right?
Right, right. So even your dead dad watches porn.
It's a very, it's totally political. It's totally liberatory, I think.
I mean, it is and it isn't. Like, it is liberatory in a certain way, but at the same time, like, I think what's interesting about fiction is that, like, you can write it, have the book, and, like, think about Obama, who, like, loved fiction, you know? Loved mm-hmm. The Wire, you know? And, like...
He loved certain fiction, yeah.
Yeah, but like, favorite character was Omar, but, like, that didn't do shit, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, and so there's a certain way that it's liberatory, but then there's this other way that mm-hmm. It has no point.
Except, right, you mean like, so you like The Wire, so why are you still making weed illegal?
Right, asshole. Right, yeah. Asshole. Like, yeah. Like, I think it, like, it shifts us if we, fiction can, like, I think it makes us see the levels of being a person in a way that's, like, more complex, but also, like, it doesn't necessarily liberate us, or, like, that's not what it's not its goal. Like, it can... I think, I mean, like The Sopranos is why I decided to go see a therapist for the first time, because I thought Dr. Melfi was, like, kind of hot. Like, mm-hmm. I was like, oh, that looks fun.
She was.
Yeah, she was. She was really hot.
She was like the original MILF, I think.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Lorraine Bracco, mm-hmm. you know, and like, and she's Jewish in Goodfellas, which I also really thought was great. She's like an Italian woman playing this, like, she was turned on by the guns and, like, by the stuff. And then she becomes the therapist who's trying to, like, help the mobster. And she's still turned on by it, you know, which is also, like, really interesting. Anyway, my therapist who I went to see was the guy who was like, you shouldn't have casual sex. He wasn't Dr. Melfi. I was disappointed.
Well, he's a Freudian, so he knows all about repression.
Right, right.
And well, he was practicing it.
How do you feel about, like, what, like, psychoanalysis, like, supposedly it's about, like, taking the repression, which is preventing us from being functional, mm-hmm. and, like, almost like airing out, you know, you want to fuck your mom in order so you don't have headaches or something that prevent you from going to work and, like, being a functional mm-hmm. human being. So it's sort of like undigging it, but then you're still.
Yeah. Yeah. So I did 10 years of psychoanalytic psychotherapy in New York City. Spent about $45,000 on it.
Oh my God.
Was in it for between 1 and 3 days a week for those 10 years. I learned a lot about myself and didn't feel any better.
Right.
At all. Ever.
Hmm. Yeah, I've heard that.
I had one symptom go away, probably because of it. I had panic attacks, and that's what sent me into therapy. And those went away. But all my other misery remained intact after those 10 years and all that money. And I'm a little pissed off about it, frankly.
Right.
Because in all those 10 years and all those hundreds or thousands of hours of that therapy, not once did a therapist say to me, you know, there's this other thing called behavioral therapy.
Right.
There are these tools. They're not fancy theory. They're not, you know, you don't have to have read Lacan. You just, they're tools. They're actually really simple, and they do look down on them. But anyway, there's these tools that you can use that actually we know have made people feel better and behave in ways that help them.
Right.
Or change behavior that is hurting them. And finally, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, I did dialectical behavioral therapy. In fact, I want to do an episode, at least one episode, on this very topic.
Yeah.
And that's all it was. It was a class, actually. There was some individual...
You didn't see, like, a behavior...
There was also individual therapy with it, but the heart of it was really the class. And it was just the class. And it met for 6 or 9 months.
Yeah.
Once a week. And the teacher just gave us these tools. When this happens, do this. When this happens, think that. When this happens, do the other thing. And I am far from perfect, but let me tell you, it changed me.
Right.
And I am... happier and better off, and it saved my relationship, and it worked. And if I did it more, it would work even more. The only reason I'm not happier is that I haven't worked at it enough.
Right.
But it's DBT. It was invented for people diagnosed with borderline personality disorder, which I fit it pretty well. I'm not exactly borderline,
right?
But I'm pretty damn close. Mm-hmm. So it may not work for everybody, but I think mm-hmm. it would work for most people. And it's just a set of tools, and I could teach it to you in an hour. I could teach you the basic tools in an hour,
yeah.
and you would probably be better off.
It'd be nice.
It really would be.
I mean, I do, the therapy that I've been in for years is called Gestalt therapy. Mm-hmm. It's a little more like woo-woo, mm-hmm. but I do like it in a certain way because it does take you into the moment. It's not just about your history. And
so DBT incorporates mindfulness. That's a part of it. That's a big part of it. And mindfulness, I believe in wholeheartedly. And mindful meditation mm-hmm. has also been very, very useful for me. And I use mm-hmm. mindfulness every day, not nearly enough, if I used mm-hmm. it more. I heard Judd Apatow once say, I know that if I meditated twice a day, I would be a much happier person, but I don't do it. What the fuck is that about? And I have the same question. Why don't I do that? I know it would make me happier, but I don't do it.
RuPaul does it. I think does yeah. like some, she's like, she doesn't matter.
He calls himself he.
No.
Yeah, he does.
Actually, there's a quote that says where there someone
or he doesn't
like,
care.
I don't care. And it's like, call me he, call me she, just call me.
Mm-hmm.
Which, so I just kind of go back and forth, but
RuPaul doesn't care.
But he needs to take a walk in the canyon and yep. has to take the walk in order to, I'm sure is crazy anyway, but like has to take the walk to like be balanced. And I was like, yeah, why don't we do those things? Like what's stopping us from doing this?
Isn't
thing?
It amazing?
Yeah. From doing that stuff.
When I meditate, it's 10 or 15 minutes. That's it.
Yeah.
It's the simplest thing. 10 mm-hmm. or 15 minutes. Jerking off takes at least that long. So, and I don't do it. If I did it once a day, I don't even do it once a day. I've never done it twice a day on a regular mm-hmm. basis. I know that if I did it twice a day, I would be much happier. Mm. But I don't do it. I won't do it today. Why not?
I won't do
it. It's amazing. So DBT incorporates mindfulness. It's a central part of it. I'm a big believer, and I'm pissed off at all those fucking psychoanalysts in New York City and elsewhere who never even
in New York City.
Mentioned any of this to me. They never mentioned it. 10 years.
I did a cognitive behavioral therapist in New York City, yeah. So it does exist there.
They have, I know, but the psychoanalysts look down on the
yeah
cognitive types. It's just a mess. But anyway, so let me tell you something that you don't know. My father died 2 weeks ago.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh.
So your father's death is a central theme in your book.
Yeah.
We agreed. And a major theme in your life
yeah.
and deeply affected you. It was really, yeah. I think, is it fair to say, a sort of a pivotal moment?
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah.
It happened when you were in college?
Yeah.
Yeah. You clearly have a lot of feelings and a lot of thoughts about it.
Mm.
I don't. Not many about my father.
About your father
Some,
dying.
Certainly. Yeah. Mostly, I'm relieved and happy about it.
Well, it also depends on the relationship that you had with him and what that was.
Indeed.
What did he die of? Like, what happened?
It was this very fast acting cancer. He was 84. Mm-hmm. He had Alzheimer's, but it was mild.
Right. And then he got,
got this one day he was fine. And then 4 days later he was dead.
Wow. Oh, that's very fast.
He had fourth stage cancer, like boom.
Whoa. Okay.
I wasn't there. I haven't talked to him in 3 years.
Oh, you had him yeah. been estranged. Yeah.
We had always been estranged, even though he raised me.
And right.
Essentially, because he mm-hmm. would probably be diagnosed with Asperger's or mm-hmm. something like that.
Mm.
Somewhere on the spectrum.
Right.
Emotionally retarded.
Right.
And just couldn't communicate. So when I left for college, I left for college and he never called, never wrote, never nothing.
Wow, yeah.
And I came home for Christmas and I was like, what the hell, Dad? You don't care? Like, this is a major thing for me. I left the state to go to college.
So
that just kept going for years and years, and I maintained the relationship.
Mm.
You know, I took care of the relationship and I made sure we had a relationship and I directed the conversations and all that.
Mm.
And I finally just got tired of it and said, you're just, I'd never got anything from him.
Right.
It was just a burden.
Right. It's very different.
I lost a burden.
Right, right.
But here's another thing about him that I think you'll find interesting and I think is relevant here. He was raised a Mormon.
Hmm.
Very repressive people. his Mormons. They're the Missouri Mormons. They were like the Utah Mormons, except they didn't do the polygamy, but you know, no alcohol. Right. So the only fun part they got rid of. So no alcohol, no tobacco, no books that weren't religious, all that stuff, just really, really puritanical. And he, this is the one thing I will say about my father that was in some ways heroic and in some ways a model for at least the work I've done and my ideas. He went all the way. So he moved to Berkeley and became a nudist and a pot smoker and a fornicator and all the rest of it. He still retained a lot of that puritanical repression, which came out in various ways, which was like this sort of harshness and hardness about things like cold medicines. We don't take cold medicines. They just make you feel better. I was like, yeah, Dad, that's the point. Yeah, we don't do that. It doesn't help anything. It just makes you feel better. But simultaneously, here's what my dad did. So he walked around naked all the time when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And he had just women just coming through the house and he would have sex with them, and I would hear it in the room next to mine when I was 5, 6, 7.
He wasn't trying to hide it, which is a whole other
9 years old. He would tell me about it sometimes too. Not a lot, but he would tell me about it, and I would hear it every night. And it got to the point where my best friend would sleep over at my house a lot, and we would start to like mock them through the walls. We would start like groaning and saying, and you know, all the humping noises. And they would start laughing back at us while they were having sex.
Wow. You were like participating.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my God.
But I heard my dad have sex my whole life as a kid. And here was his coup de grace against Mormonism. He became an atheist also and angry about religion. It was mostly because it was unscientific. He took the Book of Mormon and he was also an amateur photographer.
Yeah.
So he had a really nice camera. So he took the Book of Mormon, laid it on a table with some nice overhead lighting, took his penis out semi-erect so that it was like a bookmark laying down the gutter of the book, and took a picture of that and then framed it and put it on the mantle over the fireplace in our house. And he left it there for 5 years, Rebecca.
Wow. Oh my God.
Yeah.
You have like your childhood is like a movie.
Well, so is yours.
It was much more conventional.
Yeah, I know.
Like,
I know.
Just not the same thing.
No, my childhood is like the book about your childhood. Right? It's like your book about your childhood.
Well, I mean, that's an interesting question, though, is that like, in that case, it's sort of like the opposite of repression. Like, you're hearing it through the wall. You're seeing the penis every day. And like, do you think like that stuff was, I mean, I guess, how did that affect, like, I can't imagine how
everybody assumes it damaged me.
Right. That's my assumption. Yeah.
And I don't think it did.
Maybe it was the harsh stuff about him that damaged you, like the cold medicine.
Oh, no, definitely. Yeah, that damaged me. Not being able to talk to him about my feelings damaged me.
Right, the repression.
Oh, yeah.
The repressive stuff.
Having to take care of him emotionally damaged me when I was seven years old. His anger, his rage, that damaged me and affected me, and I carry that with me. Oh, yeah.
Right.
Thanks a lot, Dad. No, clearly, but that's actually the sexual stuff is the one thing I think that didn't hurt me. I mean, I remember it was like, have you ever seen Kramer versus Kramer, the movie?
No, but I'm scared to see it.
It's good. It's Dustin Hoffman, divorce. It's divorce, and there's a kid involved who was about my age when my parents got divorced.
Right.
And the kid stays with Dustin Hoffman, and Dustin Hoffman starts dating, and these women come over, and there's a scene where this kid, who's about 5 years old, is going to the bathroom in the middle of the night, and he's walking down the hallway in the apartment, and there's this woman who's like in her underwear standing there, who he doesn't know. This is his dad's girlfriend, and that happened to me on a regular basis. I would go to, in fact, a couple times I would go into the bathroom and there was a woman there in her bra and panties and hanging out there, and she would start talking to me and we would just be hanging out and I had to go pee in the middle of the night. Once I opened the door, the other door, because there were two doors to the bathroom. One went to my bedroom and the other went to his bedroom.
Oh my God. That's
so
very
one night
fertile.
I was 6 years old and I opened his door and I saw this thing, which I thought was like animals or a monster. It was lots of hair And I couldn't make sense of it because I was looking from the base of the bed, right? They were in the missionary position. So it was that, and the humping was going on, and they didn't know I was there, so they kept going. So I guess I saw like the balls and the vagina and all the hair, all the pubic hair and just that from that angle, it looks like this monster. It doesn't look like human beings. And that's what I thought of it. I was like, what is that thing in my father's bed going up and down like that?
Oh my God.
So there you go. So,
that's really interesting.
So what did that do to me?
Yeah, I don't know.
No, you're supposed to know. You're the fiction writer. You're smarter than me.
I mean, you were in psychoanalysis for 10 years. They must know.
They had nothing to say about it.
Isn't that the whole? Isn't that their whole point? Is like the primal scene?
You know what? I don't know what their fucking point is, frankly.
Right. But I thought I thought seeing your parents have sex or like is like a big... Hmm. Is like a big moment it's supposed to be a big moment.
The history of our culture would tell you that because we have done everything to protect children from that very moment.
Right. And that moment just happened to you.
The very thing that we protect our children from more than anything else, maybe even more than
the
death.
The thing that made them.
Even more than death. We protect them from that moment, right?
Right.
Is what I did see. It happened to me.
Right.
So maybe that's why I am who I am. I don't know. But
well,
I don't think I'm sorry about that.
I mean, the word monster, not to think that it damaged you. The word monster is kind of a negative word.
Oh yeah. No, I was a little bit scared of it, but not because it was sex. I just didn't know what it was.
Right. Cause it was like unknown.
Yeah. And it was I knew it was my father's bed.
Did you ask him the next day?
No.
No. Mm-mm. You just sort of,
we didn't start making fun of him and like, you know, acknowledging all this until I was a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was all open. He would talk about like his girlfriend's tits and stuff, but
wow.
Yeah.
And rest in peace.
He also took pictures of his girlfriends naked. He did a lot of nude photography, and he would have stacks of pictures of his girlfriends nude.
Wow. So this is like your, do you think it's made you like, it's removed you from the other people because you had such like, because it was so different?
Removed me from what other
separated
people?
You from the way that other people, because other people were not raised with this, like that it's given you this like vantage point. Or that it's like, does it make you feel like you don't understand what people are talking about when they're like being so whatever with their family?
Maybe. Yeah, maybe it. I mean, I do think it affected me, of course, but I think in a good way. I think that was good. Everything else he did was bad. I think that was actually good for me. Because, yeah, I don't think there's anything wrong with it.
Right.
With sex. Ding, ding, ding. What a bizarre thing to say, Thad. But yeah, that's, I think it was built into me, right?
Right.
Because he was so open about it.
Right.
That it was just a thing.
No, I have friends. I had a friend, two friends actually, whose parents were like, masturbation is totally healthy and wonderful. And neither of them masturbated till they were 20 because they were like told it was okay. And like then everyone whose parents were just silent about it, like just took it up at the, you know, at like 11 or 12 or whatever. And because they knew their parents knew about it, they were like, oh, I don't want to do that. Like mom just gave me like the go ahead.
Well, so I'm thinking through this now, actually. Thank you for making me do this, thinking through it. So my mother, on the other hand, was pretty conservative sexually, pretty classically conservative. You know, there was no talk about sex. I never heard them having sex. She was married to my, never had any evidence that they ever had sex, my mother and my stepfather. I found my stepfather's Playboy magazines, so I knew there was that going on, but that's, everybody's had that experience.
Right.
So they were pretty conservative, even though they were political radicals. So I did kind of, and I went back and forth. I lived with my father most of the time, but I did see my mother, so I was in both houses, right? And so I was exposed to kind of both modes.
Right.
Sexual modes in families. And I think that is really what gave me this apparatus that I have now, which is that I'm both inside the culture and an outside observer of the culture.
Right. That makes
right?
sense.
Right. Yeah. So there you go. It's funny. So he died 2 weeks ago and his wife called me and said, well, I need to give you the stuff that he left. And I was like, what the hell? But he had no money. So basically didn't care too much beyond that. But she said, yeah, well, there's a lot of pictures I want to give you. And your brother. And I was thinking,
Are they of the women?
There's one picture in particular I would like to have, actually. The Book of Mormon picture.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you need
I
that.
I think so.
Yeah, I think so.
I don't know. Maybe I don't. Do I need to see my dad's dick again?
I mean, you could put it like in a box.
I saw a lot of it.
Right. You saw it a lot. This is like, this is a, I don't even know what this would what, I mean, I don't know you that well, so I don't know what yeah, how it formed you in a certain way. I don't though, because I don't know like what the, on the day to day, like,
yeah.
like if you're, if the dad's dick, like, you know, how it presents in like,
that's my collection of short stories coming out in fall.
My dad's dick.
Published by Penguin. My dad's dick. Or the dad's dick.
The dad's dick. There's a...
What, so what's your question?
I don't know. I don't know how it affects you on the day-to-day. Like, you know, like what... Like your relationship with... You have a son, you know? Like uh-huh. If it makes you want to have boundaries with him or not or...
Hmm. I don't know. I mean, I guess you'd have to ask my girlfriends.
Mm.
You know, they know.
What do you know?
I don't... what do I know? I often wonder whether I am more sexual than your typical dude.
Right.
But I don't think so. Right. Maybe.
Right.
I don't think so though. Mm. I don't do locker room talk at all.
Mm.
I don't talk about women's body parts with my buddies much, a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Less than a lot of guys do.
Right.
How often do I masturbate? From what I understand, pretty average.
Average.
When I was a teenager, I was masturbating a lot, but we all do.
Right. That's like, yeah. That's
I mean, I don't know. Ask Dr. Drew if I'm a sexual addict. I don't think I would even fit his definition.
Right. Right.
Cause it's never like gotten in the way of right. my work or relationships like,
I guess
or anything.
My question is more specifically, like, did you decide to raise your son differently?
Hmm. So far he's 15, and so far I am more or less like my father. I mean, we try at least not to have sex around him or so that he can
That's
hear it.
It's not like your father at
no,
all.
No, I know. Okay. you got me busted. Hypocrite. No, I meant,
I mean, it's hypocritical. It's just,
no, I meant in otherwise. So we do have that, what has been called bourgeois silence.
Yeah.
The bourgeois silence around sex. We just don't talk about it. So we do have that form of silence.
Okay.
So we do separate it. We try to anyway. Although actually, no, my girlfriend and I are pretty, we're physically affectionate in front of him. But I worry about it, not because of the sex, but because of potential jealousy.
Right.
And rivalry
right.
between them.
Mm.
So it's not so much that I worry about him being exposed to sex.
Right.
It's a different dynamic that I'm worried about. But no, but otherwise I am sort of like my father in that I'm just sort of frank and open about it, and I'm not afraid of it. And so when it comes up, it comes up.
Right.
I don't have to dwell on it. I don't have to go into great detail about everything.
Right.
Regarding sex with him. But, you know, if we see something or something, someone says something or, you know, it's fine.
How's he dealing with the death of his grandpa?
He barely knew him.
Okay.
Yeah. So he didn't really care either.
Right.
Cared even less. I keep waiting for it to like hit me one day and like, oh my God, I'll be sobbing all day long. Mm. I don't think it's going to happen because I've been waiting for him to die since about 1983.
Right. You may have also like had to, this is like really, I'm sorry if I just sound like psychobabble, but like you may have also had to grieve him not being like a good dad for like way earlier.
Oh yeah.
So like grieving has like the loss of him physically, like it's like in some ways, if you've already grieved what he couldn't be.
Exactly.
In a way, like it's not the same.
So that I had been doing, yes, right. for many, many years.
Right.
And that's exactly right. And so I was prepared for this. In fact, I was sort of done grieving by the time he actually died.
Right.
Whereas
with my dad, I like wanted more dad.
Yeah, exactly.
Because so I was getting some dick.
Clearly it was a major loss to you.
Right. It was a major
loss.
Yeah.
And to me, it was actually a gain. It's true though, goddamn it. I don't care. I'm gonna say it publicly right now. No, I used to have these when I lived with him when I was a teenager. I would often have like these flashes. I would come home and I would have these like flash images of him hanging.
Oh my God.
In the hallway. He was also very depressed and very unhappy generally. And I said this to one of my therapists, and he said, well, and I said, God, I have this fear of my dad killing himself. And he said, well, maybe it's actually a wish.
It sounds like them. Yeah.
Yeah. No, but I think he was right.
Yeah, probably.
I think he was right.
That you wouldn't have to. There's this great book, speaking of fiction, called Eileen, that came out. And it's about this woman who has, she sort of takes care of her alcoholic father, and she takes care of him, but she hates him. And it's like really bold. It's talk about like brave. Like it's really like about the body and the sort of like, she's repressed, but she knows, she's telling it from like future years where she knows she was this sort of like prissy, repressed person. Eileen by Otessa Moshva.
It's a hell of a name.
I know, it's a hell of a name, right? And so she's doing something really wild in that book with like daughter, father, and kind of being stuck with your parent who's not providing a lot of empathy and parent stuff.
Yeah. It's funny when you were saying that.
She wants to kill him too, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's really important. I mean, I know someone who was also happy when her mother died, and because she was clear early on that it was just not a good relationship, that she wasn't getting anything from it except suffering. And that's a problem in our culture too, right? Mm-hmm. Because her parents have to be perfect, you know? And that's, again, sort of what you were breaking through, that idea in presenting your dad's porn stash to all of us. And the way you talk, not just that, but about your father. Oh, by the way, so he was a doctor.
Yeah.
And he was sort of a political activist, right? Like a lefty?
Not really. That's also what's funny in the book is that like the story that I think that you're talking about.
Well, there's a lot of sort of angry, liberalish activism.
But they take their activism, the parents' activism comes out in the story I think you're talking about in a community battle.
Yeah.
That's not.
It's hilarious. Like, what's the great, they have the sign that says, one way, no way. Because it's about a street that they want to.
They're worried that, like, if the street, and actually the neighborhood I'm moving into next year, there's all these signs everywhere. Like, those are actually the most.
In Eugene.
Like,
shocking.
Because they're trying to develop.
Care about such things.
They're trying to develop what's been, you know, they don't want the housing, they don't want the values of their house to go down.
They don't want low income housing for poor people.
I think it wouldn't be low income. I don't think it's low income, actually. I think it's like going to be for other rich people, but just like muddy the landscape.
Yeah. Anyway.
But
it won't be green.
It won't be green. Right. Right. And I think those battles are where the real passion is. And all that stuff about like, we're upset about the president. I'm like, you don't really give a shit about that. That's not where your passion is. Your passion is like
your backyard.
Your backyard is your passion. And as it should be in a way, but
that's true.
I mean, what was funny in that story is that they're taking this. I always thought it was when I got a little older, I was like, oh, my God, this is so funny because we're listening to these like socialist anthems and these are like doctors driving their like Toyota, you know, like listening to these socialist anthems and sort of, you know, and the generations go back like further where like grandpa was in the party or whatever. But it I think
we haven't mentioned that you're Jewish.
Right. Grandpa was in the party.
Yeah. Jewish New York Jews. See, this is a whole thing. Like, you're either, I've been around those people in that culture my whole life.
Yeah. Berkeley.
And so I know all about it and I'm very familiar with it, but a lot of people just don't get it. They don't know it. And it's this whole thing. It's got its own code and everybody's got a communist grandfather.
You have to.
Right.
Even if they're just a communist for like a day.
Every Jew in this country has a communist grandfather.
Right.
Who may or may not be dead, by the way.
Right. But there's this loyalty to like, I mean, I think that the Jews have gone further to the right in certain ways. Like there are definitely people, Republican.
Yeah. Well, Jews, the neoconservatives,
right. The neocons.
They were communists and their fathers were communists and they, they ditched their fathers sort of in an Oedipal thing, right? Mm-hmm. They're killing their fathers by becoming Republicans.
Right. Yeah. Right. And like killing lots of people too.
Yeah, in the process.
In the process.
So, but wait, hold on. So your father wasn't one of those? He wasn't an activist? He wasn't an angry liberal neighborhood activist?
He was like kind of your garden variety liberal, but he wasn't very, that was the extent of his activism. Like he was sort of, activism kind of flared up.
Okay, so that was made up. That story.
There was some community, there was a real community battle actually. And when I went to read in my hometown, people were still like angry about it.
North Shore, Long Island, correct?
Yeah, North Shore of Long Island. My mother actually is from Brazil. And
I didn't know that.
Yeah, she's a Brazilian Jew. And they were very left.
Yeah.
And her brother was actually blacklisted during the dictatorship.
Huh.
And was like making speeches. And my mother went to like a few meetings and like saw the guns and was like, oh, not for me. Like, I'm totally too scared.
Good move. Good move, mom.
Good move, mom. She's very practical. She's like, no guns, no violence. Thanks. Huh. I'm out. But my uncle got blacklisted and was heavy duty and was, you know, being blacklisted was really they were afraid he was going to go to jail and be tortured. But then all the left in Brazil became the government later,
That tends to happen.
And then
lo and behold, what do? They put people in prison. Isn't that funny how that happens? Every time. It's just amazing how that always happens.
It's amazing how that always
happens. They say they're anti-prison and then they start putting people in prison when they get power. Gosh.
I was thinking about Pete Seeger because when he died, I knew he was a Stalinist, but when he died, I posted a song and you were like, he was Stalinist. And I was like, I know he was.
Oh, I got mad at you?
You got a little mad at me, but I knew he was.
He deserved it.
I couldn't help it. It was just like, I just knew those songs so well. And I was just, I wasn't like celebrating his politics, but I just really liked the songs, some of the songs. But he said something like, he knew, which was a little cool of him, which was like, he was like, if the communists ever took over, I'd be the first person they'd throw in prison. Or something.
No,
he'd throw people in prison, I guess.
Dude, Pete Seeger was publicly supporting.
I know he was.
The Soviet Union in the 1970s. Like, I mean,
he was late.
Good God, that guy has blood on his hands. I mean, really, he does. He was defending the gulag, literally.
Yeah, he was.
Pretending it wasn't there. I mean, it is just incredible.
He changed the words.
Man, did the commies hate my guts when he died? Because I was right up on Twitter saying all this, and it was like, I was going to say it was like their father died.
Right.
And guess what? He did. I mean, that's what he was to them. I mean, really, it was like I was cursing out their father the way they responded to me.
So, you know, so Somewhere Over the Rainbow from The Wizard of Oz. Yeah. So I went to see Dar Williams play, because I do bougie things like that. Mm-hmm. I go see Dar Williams, and I really like Dar Williams, but she sang the Pete Seeger version of Somewhere Over the Rainbow, which... the end is like, why can't I, and it's very like, it's very much about the individual, and he changed it to why can't you and I.
See?
And I was so mad. I was like, the whole point of that line is that it's like this individual longing for be over the rainbow and to, you know, and like, and it ruins it. It just ruins the line to make it this like,
well, it ruins collective. It for you and me.
For you and I.
But the commies love it.
Right, the commies love it. But it was really interesting because I was thinking about like how that's a, you know, that's a musical, right? And popular culture, talking about popular culture, that's a musical, not like a beloved folk singer. That's, exactly. I don't know who wrote The Wizard of Oz, but in like that longing and then that musical has become such like for gay men, like such a huge, became like this, you know, the rainbow symbol itself, like the whole like
that's not where the rainbow flag came from, is it?
I think so.
Really? The rainbow thing is from The Wizard of Oz?
Yeah, Dorothy. Friends of Dorothy.
Really?
Yeah.
I knew the gays loved Judy Garland. I didn't know about the rainbow.
I think
coming from there.
We gotta look it up.
Someone get on this right away. We have to have a whole episode devoted to this.
Am I making that up because I wanted to be true?
No, you could be right. Okay. I know there's a Judy Garland thing among the gay boys.
Judy Garland thing and the rainbow and I think that like also taking that song or that moment of why can't I, you know?
It's about being free from Kansas, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Being free from Kansas, go somewhere where it's in fucking color.
Exactly.
For once and not live on your aunt's farm.
Yeah. It's gay liberation, but it's really individual liberation.
Right.
That's about. Okay.
Right.
And so, of course, then Seeger takes it and makes it into, you know, no, come back to Kansas. We'll have a collective farm there, though. It'll be much better.
It's going to be so much better, Auntie M. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, he's basically like, come back. I mean, the movie ends like there's no place like home, and that's like been the, she winds up back in Kansas. Mm-hmm. But that's not as important as no one really, they sort of had to tack that on, I think.
But you know what, though? You're going back home. You have a long-term relationship now. You live in Oregon now.
Mm.
And you know what? I think the last time you and I had a conversation on Facebook, you were talking about having kids.
I don't know if I'm going to do that or not.
But you really wanted them.
I did?
Yeah. You don't remember this? You really had a strong urge to have children, to be a mom.
Well...
Is that gone?
It's different.
Good.
I think when it became... Like, it's different. Like, I do think, like when I see a baby, I, like, smile. Like, I have the, like, like, that feeling.
You were trained well?
I was well, kind of. I do think, like, I'm just, you know, I am, like, I do think I'd be able to, like, love a kid that with that, like you have it, you know, mm-hmm. like that. I want to love somebody that way.
Sure.
Like I still do, you know? And I think that, but being a parent looks really, really, really hard. Mm-hmm. And so that's the part of me that
I'm not allowed to say that anymore in my house. I get in trouble when I say
with
that.
Who?
Guess who? He listened to the episode in which I said that.
Oh, he didn't like
that. And I got into trouble. So I can't say that, but you can.
Being a parent looks really hard. Being a parent of little kids looks especially hard. I think being a parent of a teenager looks hard in like a more sort of...
Nah, it's a snap. It's easy. You'll have a great time. That whole stroller thing, no problem. You just walk down the street and everything works. Yeah.
But yeah, I don't feel like some people have like baby fever. I mean, I'm really running out of time, like biologically, maybe.
No, you really were, this was like a year ago. You really wanted to have kids and I got it and I didn't tell you not to because I had the exact same feeling, even though I'm a dude.
Right. You want a kid.
I very much so. But right. I also haven't gone through it. There's like half of me, it's kind of like watching the gays all want to get married. Mm-hmm. It's that feeling, you know, it's like,
to yourself. I know what you're saying.
No, like, you know, so I'm like, guys, I'm not going to get in your way. And, you know, have at it.
Right.
But it's kind of makes me sad, you know,
right.
Cause I just, cause you beautiful free people who escaped Kansas. Now you're going to go straight back to the house.
My friend Tom won't do it. He's like, I'm not going to get married. I'm not going to have kids. Fuck that. That makes gay not fun.
Exactly.
I want it to be fun. It's not fun anymore. He's saying like he thinks the closet was more fun because of all the like sneaking around.
He probably has a point. He's probably right.
He's actually. Like that. He's like, I would have been such a good, like,
well, the closet was definitely more fun than marriage. That's for sure.
Right. Oh, yeah. He was like,
no doubt about that.
He like really wishes, like, he's like, I would have been a really good closeted husband for a woman who wanted that. Like I could have like snuck around and done all the fun things I wanted to do. So he's like a longing for like, yeah, I think he's just like, but, you know, marriage is really, it's also like, it's like, right. You can't tell someone like you can't want that. Cause I wanted it. Right. Like there's some, there's a hypocrisy there too. Mm-hmm. Like, though you're not married now, right?
No, but for all intents and purposes, we are.
You're domestic
just
partners.
Not, yeah. Right? Just not formally, but oh sure. We act like we're exactly like a married couple.
Right.
Otherwise. No, come on. I mean, we're just conflicted. You and I and most people, right? That's all it is. And basically you just have to accept that we're conflicted about these things. Mm. We want the freedom and we want the security and the stability and the constant love and all that simultaneously. Right. And it just sucks.
And you can't have both.
What are you going to do? Yeah. But accept that conflict.
Right. I mean, what do you think about open relationships?
Good luck.
Good luck.
You think they work?
Do you think people are really giving it a try?
Have you ever had one? Oh, you kind of did, didn't you?
Like I had two long distance boyfriends, speaking of distance.
Did they have beards?
One of them did and the other didn't.
Okay.
But both times we were open while apart, but it was sort of like, don't ask, don't tell. It wasn't like, let's process like that you had sex with that person today. And I've been watching, I'm watching the couples. They seem a little less bored maybe.
You're watching the open
marriage people because they do seem a little less.
They're less bored.
They're less bored, but they still kind of are in bored. Like I still think they're bored because they're married. Like sex isn't the only thing that is freedom to marriage. Like I think like you can have sex, but then you still have to go like back and like it's really like making meals and doing the dishes that's
totally.
The problem.
It's domestic labor.
Right.
That's most of it.
Yeah. Right.
Domestic marriage labor. And parenting. It's just a lot of domestic labor.
Yeah. I hate domestic labor.
Yeah.
Right.
That's really most of it.
Well, what's the solution for that?
Technology.
Like the vacuum cleaner?
And extended families.
Why extended families?
Instead of the nuclear family taking care of the kids, the two people doing all the labor.
Mm-mm.
I want grandma, grandpa, aunts, uncles, cousins, neighbors, everybody.
Right.
Everybody on board doing the work with us.
Sounds like it takes a village.
With lots of, except for that part. Yeah. Except for no Hillary running the village. But yeah. And then lots of gadgets to do the work for us.
Okay.
Otherwise.
Like the dishwasher is an amazing invention.
Totally. Can you imagine? I mean, those fucking housewives before that stuff.
I didn't have a dishwasher till.
Before World War II.
Right.
You know. There were no dishwashers. There were no washing machines.
Well, there's also the return. Speaking of like the like. Hippy dippy people. There's the
vacuum cleaner
trying to bring back the cloth diaper.
Oh, yeah. No, and fuck those people and kill them.
This woman was like trying to get her in-laws to help her wash.
Not her, yeah. They can do it if they want.
Her cloth diapers. And I was like, that labor, we've already figured that one out. Like, that's labor you don't have to do that you're now adding.
Well, that's
back.
What the hippie communes were all about. It was about actually going back to the pioneer days when we did all that labor ourselves and didn't use labor-saving technology, and we were closer to the earth and closer to our bodies. Right. And what we're going to do is we're going to work all the time.
Right.
That's the last chapter in Renegade History of the United States.
Right. We're going to work. It's like the work, but the work is... good and is you.
Yeah, they became Puritan communes where everybody worked all the time because they had to.
Right.
Because they had to fell the trees to make fire to warm themselves in the winter and plant the corn.
Yeah, fires
and
keeping the fire burning. This is a really story I like. My grandmother, when she liked to tell the story that her friend, like when the 60s happened and like some people my dad's age were like, we're joining a commune. Her friend was like, I grew up on a farm. That's so much work. They're not going to make it. Mm-hmm. Like, they don't understand how much work that is. Like, that sucked.
Yeah.
Like,
that's why hardly any communes exist anymore.
Right. Because it sucked too much.
Because they realized it was just constant work.
I have relatives in Israel who had a kibbutz, and now they just all the labor is done by Thai laborers.
Yeah.
Everybody
moved from the kibbutz to Tel Aviv to like skyscraper apartments in Tel Aviv. Because they knew better. Jews ain't stupid. I mean, they're not that stupid. They were stupid for a while.
I have relatives who founded a kibbutz, and then don't do any of they don't pick olives anymore.
Hell no, you hire the immigrants for that stuff.
Yeah, but then what about the immigrants?
That's basically the Jewish story right there. That's like the history of Jews right there. We just did it.
Hire the
immigrants. We didn't talk about the Holocaust, but otherwise that covers it.
We skipped the Holocaust and we skipped the the Lower East Side and the factories.
Yeah. So by the way, just so everyone knows, like I'm a quarter Jewish, which I think technically means that I would have been killed in the Holocaust, and I can also make Jewish jokes.
Yeah, you can make Jewish jokes.
I can clear that with you.
I just thought, I knew you were like a quarter, but I think you were probably a fan.
On my mom's side, by the way.
It's a very strong G. It's very strong.
Oh, totally.
So I think you've been affected by it.
Yeah, yeah. But I can make the jokes and stuff, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Good.
Yeah, you're a madman. You're totally allowed to make the jokes.
Good.
If your mother is partly Jewish, mm-hmm. if you had a Jewish mother, basically.
And I've been around Jews my whole life, too.
Yeah.
Until now, I got rid of them. By the way, I did. No, so I'm now with a WASP for the first time in my whole life. It was always Jews and Catholics, all the women I've been with until now. First WASP. I'm like, God damn, you guys never fight. No arguments. The scotch is excellent. And
I want the scotch.
It's just, they just kind of like just glide through life. It's just like they're skating. They never fight. There's never raised voices. Seriously.
I know there aren't.
How do you all do that?
I had a roommate in college who was, I had one Jewish roommate and a WASPy roommate, and she was like, you guys are always yelling at each other. Mm-hmm. She was really like upset about it. And we
Catholics
were like,
and Jews, all they do is just scream at each other.
Loudness. Though my parents
there's
were
always drama.
Quieter, a little quieter.
The WASPs, literally, they have no drama at all. They have these families and there's no drama. You have no idea that there's any conflict at all between any two people in those families. It's astonishing how they pull it off.
Is that repression, though?
I think that's how they built all the bridges, basically. That's the sublimation that Freud talked about. So that all that energy about hating each other, they just channel it into the work, the labor. And that's why they're like the insurance executives and stuff.
What about the drinking?
Well, that too. And that helps.
What about back to fiction? Like, what about like Cheever, like the misery of the sort of...
Yeah, it's all submerged.
It's submerged.
But I'm just saying, so the stuff they can't channel goes into the scotch. And the stuff they do channel builds America.
Right.
So thank you for that.
Thanks for America.
Because I do like the infrastructure more or less, you know, it's pretty good. So what are you working on now? What's the next thing?
I'm still writing stories. More of them. I'm actually writing.
You don't want to do a novel?
I do eventually, but I don't know. I don't know why. It's not like happening yet.
I don't need you to write a novel at all. I don't.
People really want it.
I know. I don't. After you read these stories, why would you want a novel? I just want more of that.
I'm trying to write a story about a woman who's involved with an older man. So I'm trying to go into that. That like the reasons for that, like, and what that dynamic is like. So I'm kind of that's not in the first book. So
right.
See how that goes.
God. Do you have a contract yet?
No. You don't get that till till you have more on the page.
Oh, in fiction, you have to have it almost all written, don't you?
Sometimes you can get away with not, but yeah, you do have to.
Nonfiction, you can sell.
Because you're proposing the idea.
Yeah,
right?
Nonfiction, you can sell just an idea. You can sell one page written. Yeah. Some people can. No, you're a brilliant writer, really. I'm kind of amazed by you. No, I'm very amazed by you, and I'm humbled by you.
I'm amazed by that everything you're doing with the. I want to read your next book too.
So do I.
Will you finish that for us?
Stop doing that to me, everybody. I'm trying.
You're trying.
Stop wasting my time, Rebecca. I'm trying to get it done.
This is a long podcast.
Thank you so much for doing this, and great to finally meet my sexting partner. In person.
I know. Those were good times. Those were good days.
I'm telling you, it wasn't the worst sex I've had. It was not the worst sex.
It's good days for my sexting life.
And on that note, are you speechless now?
Yeah.
Okay, good. I guess then we should end.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
The amazing response to this show has made it possible for me, for the first time in my life, to have a career where I no longer have to worry about what the people who run universities think about me. But right now, that's only a possibility. So if you like this show and want to keep it going, and you want to make this adjunct professor into a former adjunct professor, I need your help. I've started a program for supporters of the show. You can join it at unregisteredlisteners.com. If you make a contribution, you won't just be helping the show, you'll also be joining an online community that I've created, where we can all talk to each other, and you'll receive gifts of unregistered merchandise, access to archived episodes, transcripts of the interviews, autographed copies of my books, access to webinars on history, politics, culture, and philosophy, and a free download of my 11-part lecture course on A Renegade History of the United States. I really hope you can join me in this remarkable project. And thanks for listening.